You're listening to the OneOfUs.net Podcast Network.
Something's coming.
Stand by.
Hold on to your hats. Here we go.
Welcome to the Screamcast, episode 97. I am Sean DeRager, and with me is BJ Colangelo.
Oh, hello.
Brad ditched us to spend some time with his lady.
It's fair. It's International Women's Day, so...
Totally.
So, good ups on you, Brad.
Yep. Meanwhile, I told my wife to go in the other room and watch Felicity. So... I mean, asshole.
If anyone learned anything from Deadpool, it's going to be a fun night for all.
him and I interviewed Pete Toombs from Mondo Macabro, and we'll be getting that in just a little bit, talking about Lizard in a Woman's Skin. So stay tuned for that. But first, BJ, we got to get to what's on our doorstep.
Holy cow, I almost forgot.
We'll get the door.
Pizza.
And since Brad's not here, this may be a short and sweet.
Oh my gosh, it's going to be 35 seconds long. So I have two. I'll start with the one that is a little bit easier to find. I checked out Hellenbeck. It's on Netflix, and it is the animated, it's like Paranorman, but for adults.
Right.
It's stop motion. It's an adult fantasy comedy, and, the voice cast in it is out of control. It's like Nick Swardson, Mila Kunis, Bob Odenkirk, TJ Miller, Susan Sarandon, Danny McBride, Rob Riggle, who else is in it? There's just people all
it's
over
like
the place.
Everyone,
yeah. Jennifer Coolidge she has a bit role in it. H. John Benjamin does as well. It is fun, but it seems like they got all of these really talented people all in one room and said, "Welp, let's just hope for the best." It's a film that I think works a lot better as a premise and not necessarily as a story. It seems like a lot of the jokes are funny. They just don't necessarily fit in the world that they've shaped. The animation is fantastic. It's really, really well done. The story isn't that great. Basically it follows a guy who breaks a blood oath, on the Book of Satan, and then he gets taken down to hell and his buddies have to go down to hell and, rescue him. That's the loose plot of it. But it's just riddled with a bunch of like really inappropriate jokes, which they're all funny. They just don't necessarily fit in kind of this film. I definitely would recommend it. I always recommend any sort of kind of stop motion or animation because it's an art form that I don't want to ever die out. Mm-hmm. And the only way to keep it going is if we keep supporting it. I think it was a very, very good effort by all of those that were involved. It's directed by one of the guys, Tom Giannis. I'm sorry for butchering your name. I know that he worked on like Sarah Silverman's Jesus's Magic and Half My Face and like the Tenacious D show and Nick Swardson's Pretend Time. So he's more of kind of like a sketch comedy guy, which I think Hellenbeck would have worked better as.
Right.
Maybe got stretched
into a feature length probably was, not the best choice.
Yeah. I think that it would have been much better suited if it would have been, like a Robot Chicken style show, which I believe the people who do the Robot Chicken, effects are the people that made it, so that makes a lot of sense to me. But I think that it would have been much, much better suited to be half hour increments of these guys in hell trying to get their friend back on Adult Swim. That would have been the smarter choice. But that's not how it went down. So we have Helen back. Check it out. Don't be, you know, confused by the animation. This is not a kid's movie, so don't watch it with the children.
Yeah, there's another one coming out with Seth Rogen. Seth Rogen did a stop motion.
Of course he did. I don't know which one one is.
They're all like, it's food. There's like a hot dog.
Are they food or is it about food?
They're food, like food characters. Like the girl is a hot dog bun and the guy is a hot dog, of course.
Oh, it's Where's Wally?
Where's Wally?
That's what it is. Yeah, Where's Wally? It's they're children's books.
No. This is an adult. This is an adult stop motion.
Oh, they're doing an adult one?
I forget the name of it.
Why did I say Where's Wally? They're doing Where's Waldo. My brain is gone. No, he's doing the Where's Waldo film. Sorry. No, I didn't know he was doing an adult stop motion.
I can't remember what the heck it is. And I just saw a picture of it. All it was a bunch of food products standing in line. Oh, it's called Sausage Party.
Of fucking course it is. Oh, God.
We'll see how that goes. This is the kind of, as a parent, this is the kind of stuff that, like, terrifies me. Because I was like, oh, God. Cause, like, with Helen back, which my kids, because, you know, they see me watching this kind of stuff, and to them, oh, well, this is animated, so this is fun. I could totally see them grabbing that by mistake. And then Sausage Party, it's a bunch of fun-looking food characters. You know, a bagel, a hot dog bun.
Well, just, you know, parent your kid and do what you gotta do. And I don't think they'll find it. I mean, they have the kids locks on Netflix for a reason.
Oh yeah.
So make sure. Which
I lock the shit down.
Yeah, they don't need to know the things that get suggested for you.
No.
So yeah, I saw Helen back, but the one that I am super excited to talk about, and if you haven't seen it, I'm going to be bummed, but I saw Dan O'Bannon's The Resurrected, known as The Ancestor or Shatterbrain.
It's on my list. I got the imported Blu-ray.
Oh,
and
my
it's like
goodness.
Sitting right here staring at me, that telling me to watch it.
So first things first. Dual role Chris Sarandon. So y'all know how I feel about that. the emotions I felt. I was gifted The Resurrected for Valentine's Day. And I got a DVD of it. So it's not even like the weird foreign Blu-ray. I got the out of print DVD as a gift.
I mean, this foreign Blu-ray is pretty sexy though. It's a big box too.
It probably is.
And I don't like big boxes because they're, you know, they're taller than the Blu-ray, but in this case,
they don't fit.
It's
anything.
So pretty that I give it a pass.
Well, the DVD, was very, very unexpected to get.
Nice.
The Resurrected is, it hits that sweet spot of all of the weird late night films that I watched that I shouldn't have been watching when I was a kid, because we all forget I had neglectful parents. I watched whatever the fuck I wanted. It starts off as kind of this sort of office drama where everything's kind of sleazy and silk stockings feeling. And then it turns into a Dan O'Bannon film, and there's weird stop motion, there's like over the top gore and creature effects, and it just goes fucking haywire. There's a Revolutionary War reenactment in the middle of it. It's bonkers, but it is so fun, and it completely emulates that early 90s style of filmmaking when they were trying so desperately to not be making a slasher film, mm-hmm. where everything was still really sleazy, but was trying really hard to be a high art film. It falls in that kind of window. It's based on the H.P. Lovecraft novella, The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, which, you know, if, I don't know if you've ever read that before, but it's one of Lovecraft's weirder stories. Seeing it as a film is always an exciting thing. I love seeing the different – Lovecraft's like horror Shakespeare to me, where the different interpretations and different stylized ways of retelling his stories is what's most interesting to mm-hmm. me. And this was, you know, definitely one of them because it throws it into that beautiful 90s style where everybody has the glass paneled windows with the bright blue on the other end. So everything looks like a checkerboard. But it's a lot of fun. I don't know what the fucking voice is that Chris Sarandon is using in this movie, but I've never heard it before and it's great. It's so great. So, I watched it, that and Helen Back in the same night. So I had Susan Sarandon first and then I had Christopher Sarandon. And
nice.
Chris Sarandon is still my favorite. Also, I'm not sure if you heard that, but someone is yelling outside my house.
I did not hear it. Your new phone is paying off.
Oh, thank God. Born hood, stay hood. Someone's out there screaming. So my apologies about that. But yeah, that's what's on my doorstep. Of the two, I highly, highly recommend The Resurrected. It's not that easy to find, but if you find it, you buy it and you watch it and you love it.
Yes. I mean, Brad basically sent me a text and said, The Resurrected, German box, buy it. And it was like $40.
Worth it.
But he said it was worth it, so I trusted him on it. And I was like, you better be right.
I've been trying to get it out of Zach how much he paid for this Valentine's Day gift, and he won't tell me. So, yeah,
it's tough when these things are hard to find, but stuff like this. I'm surprised that The Resurrected isn't out, you know?
So yeah, I don't know who has the rights to it. Especially, you'd think that it would have done something, especially since Dan O'Bannon has now passed.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when somebody passes, everybody tries to scoop up their shit and sell it. And this didn't get sold like that. So I don't know who has control of it.
Well,
I don't know.
It's an MGM title, so.
Oh, well.
So it's up for bid for sure.
Well,
like the whole
looks like
MGM catalog is people are bidding on, so.
Well, it looks like I'm going to have to start some obnoxious tweet campaign get that a proper release. And,
so it'll be
Kino
or Scream Factory or what other companies are touching MGM films these days? Arrow.
Well, if it's Scream Factory, I will fly out there and interview Chris Sarandon for you free of charge. I will pay for my own lodging.
There you go.
But yeah, that was my doorstep. Okay. What did you see?
I got a package from Mill Creek. They were kind enough to send me a few review copies. They got a new publicist person.
Very nice.
And because before they were like, well, you know, you only focus on horror, so we're not really gonna send you a whole lot, you know. But they've been very kind to ask me what releases will fit with the show and the website. So they sent me, there's a couple more I'll be talking about. I'll be talking about My Boyfriend's Back here within the next couple weeks.
Hell
and
yeah.
Then, My Science Project is on deck. But the first thing that I watched that I was super curious about was a 2003 miniseries by Hallmark, yet another take on Frankenstein. And there's been so many takes on Frankenstein. I mean, in fact, I think this last week, a new film came out, you know, a new Frankenstein film came out that is apparently pretty good, I guess.
Another one?
Yeah. Well, it came out in the UK first and then it's out here, but it's a modern take on Frankenstein is the one that's in stores right now. Bare bones disc. But so, I mean, it's just crazy how many adaptations of Frankenstein there are, and this one, since it's a Hallmark film, they're claiming that this is the closest to the original book than anything else that's ever been adapted.
Yeah, because nothing's been anywhere near it.
No, and it stars Luke Goss as Frankenstein's monster. William Hurt is in it, and then Donald Sutherland is in it as kind of a bookend character because it opens up in Antarctica somewhere. It's some frozen body of water where there's a ship stuck and he's a ship captain. He basically runs into, stuff goes down and he runs into Dr. Frankenstein, Victor Frankenstein, played by, is it Alec Newman? Who I'm not really familiar with anything he's been in.
Yeah, I'd have to look him up. The name sounds familiar, but it's not ringing a bell.
IMDb is failing me. It just shows the names and not what anyone plays, except for William Hurt. But so Donald Sutherland's great. I mean, he's, you know, so it's kind of told in flashback, and Victor Frankenstein is telling, you know, Donald Sutherland's character about what went down. Production value is pretty high for a Hallmark film. This is back in 2003, 2004. And I think in 2004, USA Channel had a TV movie based on a Dean Koontz adaptation of Frankenstein. So it was it's just weird.
Wait, is this the one that has Parker Posey in it?
This is not the one with Parker Posey, no. No,
I know
I think that's the USA Channel one.
Yeah, that came out the same year, and yeah. I had never seen it, but we have these like reseller shops called The Exchange out in Ohio, and that's where I find like a lot of my weird stuff, because a lot of times people give things up that they don't know what they have. But I saw the USA TV movie cover, and I'd never seen it, and I almost bought it, and I wish I would have, because that would have made a great discussion, but I did not.
Yeah, I'm curious about that one. I mean, when I got this, I was kind of like, you know, I let out a sigh as I put it into my Blu-ray player. Blu-ray player, like, this is probably gonna be bad, but it's pretty damn good. I was really surprised, and I can tell it was kind of closer, because I've read the original book by Mary Shelley.
I'd hope so, because I assume that you went to high school.
Yeah, did everyone in high school read? I think I read it on my own. I don't think I read it.
Ours was required reading. Mm-hmm.
That damn required reading, but I remember in the book that Frankenstein is actually pretty intelligent, and they follow that along here, where he's kind of this like bastard child, you know, doesn't really know who his creator is, why he's alive. It's like his brain's rerouting, and he's a combination of all these different body parts. And Luke Goss plays him pretty well. I mean, Luke Goss was in Hellboy 2, so he's not.
He's not a bad actor.
He's good when he's in the right role.
And he's not a stranger to like these kind of oddball roles that mm-hmm. most actors would turn their nose up at. I mean, he can do it.
Yeah, I really had a lot of fun with this, and I liked that they played it straight, and it's more played at the drama, the struggle with, you know, Victor Frankenstein and the struggle with his monster. And it's not just this, you know, it has its horror moments, but it's not, you know, trying to rely fully on horror. It's a pretty damn good adaptation. I was really surprised. And it's only like $8, like Mill Creek stuff. That's generally pretty cheap because it's bare bones, but
yeah.
This looks really great. It's a fantastic transfer. And for $8, if you're interested, you know, if you're not worn out with Frankenstein adaptations and you want to give this a shot, $8 is not bad to take a chance on something. I'm not sure if this is streaming anywhere, like on Netflix or whatever, but it's one of the Frankenstein flicks adaptations I would definitely give it a shot. It's about 3 hours long, so it's not that bad.
It's not terrible.
2.5-hour increments, and I would say give it a shot. I had fun with it. So.
Well, sweet.
Yeah. And that's it. I've been preparing. We're going to be talking to Arrow sometime. We're trying to arrange that. So I've been going through the American Horror Project Blu-rays.
Okay.
And I know we're going to go in depth on them later, but I got to say, if you can buy the set now, I would, because it's going to sell out and you're going to kick yourself for not buying it, because it's really damn good. The movies are The Witch Who Came from the Sea, The Premonition, and then Malatesta's Carnival of Blood. Two of these films are really well done films. One of these is a whack job of a bonkers film, but it's great. So that's all I'm going to say about that. Because we're going to be going in depth on these movies, I think, with the Arrow guys at some point in the future. But this thing's selling fast. There's a few places that have it for a decent price. I know that grindhousevideo.com has it for a decent price there. Amazon's been fluctuating between like $60 and $80. If you want to get the UK version and want to wait a little bit, go to Amazon UK and order there, because it's generally going to be about $20 cheaper than the US version. It's the same exact thing, except on the box it has their little certification sticker or certification badge or whatever. So if that stuff annoys you, pay an extra $20 and get the US version. But if you want to save money, definitely get it from Amazon UK. But it's definitely, if you're listening to the show and you're a fan of the movies we talk about, this thing is definitely worth the money. So
sweet.
All right. Well, we're going to jump into the interview with Pete Toombs from Mondo Macabro about woman in a lizard skin. I always want to switch them around and say, is it lizard in a woman's skin or woman in a lizard skin?
Woman in a lizard skin.
Or no, is it lizard in a woman's skin? See, I guess I get confused. And right now.
Oh, it is a lizard in a woman's skin. You've been fucking me up all day.
I know.
You kept saying it, and then I was thinking to myself that I was wrong this mm-hmm. whole time. But nope, you were wrong.
I've been doing this for a week, and I haven't gotten it right. A lizard in a woman's.
A lizard in a woman's skin.
A lizard in a woman's skin. 1971. Lucio Fulci. And I loved this film. It was my first time watching it. And I think this is probably now
my... It's a fucking trip.
It's my favorite Fulci film now.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I like how restrained... I like how restrained it is. And I like that it's... Because I was introduced to batshit crazy Fulci. You know, with Zombie and On. But this is pre-crazy Fulci. And I really liked the restraint on this and the framing. But I wanted to know, we'll get into that in the interview with Pete. But I wanted to know, BJ, like, what your thoughts on A Lizard in a Woman's Skin.
I'm a big fan of any film that is going to be centered around some sex and drug orgies. no, I really do like this one. But I can't think of Lizard in a Woman's Skin without discussing the fucking dog hallucination, which has scarred me for life. God, if I remember correctly, that moment was kind of the start of when, you know, filmmakers had to start proving that their special effects were real, or were special effects and not like a snuff film. I want to say that was what started it.
Yeah,
I believe. That's gross. But no, I do really like this one. I think I've gone on record before saying that of the two, I tend to prefer Argento to Fulci films. Mm. Like I said, anything with, you know, drug induced sex orgies, I'm all about it. I think we need more of it.
It happened a lot in the late 60s. You saw a lot of that in these movies based in like the late 60s, early 70s.
And I don't understand why that's not still a thing. It's not like people aren't still having drug.
Well, it's not as common. The whole AIDS thing happened. And
well, that's true.
Kinda, you know.
Yeah.
Put a damper on that.
Yeah. R.I.P. Nancy Reagan.
Yeah.
Burn in hell, bitch.
Oh, Jesus.
Sorry. I have no show today.
Amazing.
Yeah.
All right.
But
well,
no, I do like it, and I'm bummed that I missed the interview because I'm sure that it was great.
Pete's a great guy. I love talking to him. He's gonna be on the show more. There's a few titles coming out from Mondo Macabro that I think we're gonna try to lump together and get Pete back on, and we'll try to work our schedules, BJ, so you are there.
Beautiful.
We love talking to Pete. All right, so let's jump into this interview here about A Lizard in a Woman's Skin with Mondo Macabro's Pete Toombs. And then we'll come back with more. Stick around. Well, making his return to the Screamcast is Pete Toombs from Mondo Macabro. Pete, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be back.
I've been digesting Lizard in a Woman's Skin for the past couple of days, and this is my first time watching this film. I'd never seen it before, and I'd heard about it. And, you know, Lucio Fulci, it always gets thrown around whenever you bring up or whenever I'm in conversations about Fulci, but I'd never seen it. And then the first time I really heard about it was when Scream Factory was going to be releasing, they're going to be slapping it on like a DVD. And then people were excited that it was actually going to get some sort of release, and then they had to back out of it because I think you guys had the rights. And but I was excited, happy to see you guys released it on Blu-ray, and it's restored, and it's just
Well, we didn't hear anything. They just pulled it. Was that the case, Pete? I mean, can you talk about that? Where they just
I don't know actually what the situation was there. I think there was some issue around. You know, this we'll get into this later, I guess. But the film had a number of titles, and I think it one of the American titles it was released under was Schizoid. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's another film with that title. You know, the Klaus Kinski in it.
Yeah.
And I'm not entirely 100% sure that. That Shout didn't maybe confuse the two. I don't want to say, you know, I know Cliff well, and I've known him for a long time, and you know, I don't want to say too much because I don't really know, but I mm-hmm. think it may have been something about that you know, there was a mix up over the titles and the materials or something, but you know, beyond that I don't really know.
Yeah, but everyone was excited, you know. The thing is, like, everyone was excited, and then all of a sudden it was gone, and then we got the announcement.
Well,
that was exciting.
It got the press copies got out, but however, I don't think it ever got distributed. Oh, well,
It was the same film then, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was the right film.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so it has. I mean, of course, they did the press, and then they destroyed, you know, the remaining ones, and they put what is the name of that movie that they put on there? I can't remember, but they replaced it with another film because they released Schizoid later on with their with X-Ray, I think it was, that they put, yes, you know, Hospital
right.
Massacre.
Right.
But yeah, they just did a press release. The press copies went out, and then immediately they pulled it. So the film's actually on there, but maybe because of the different titles and, you know, I'm not 100% sure, because the last time it was released on DVD, I think, was Image. Released it in over here in
I think
in
it was Media Blasters, maybe Media Blasters.
Media Blasters. Well, it was one of those titles that seemed to had a lot of releases under different titles.
Yeah,
So I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I could see the confusion, probably, especially with, you know, some of these European titles, rights issues, and who owns it and when they're expired. So, you know, no fault there. But it was actually nice to see it. Eventually, you know, come out in, you know, on Blu-ray in, you know, really, really well done restoration.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. Yeah, I mean, that was the good thing, I think, being able to do it on Blu-ray, because it had been out on DVD before, and I think there was an issue with the. I know there is an issue with the materials available as to exactly what version was released, you know, because there was bits missing and so on. And I know that, you know, that Media Blasters put it out a couple of times, maybe even three times, you know, with different versions, because the American version was, you know, the American cut was different from the European cut and all that kind of stuff. And it was good that we were able to do it on Blu-ray, and we were able to, obviously, in a sense, take advantage of all those previous releases and try and make ours the definitive one, you know, the one that had all the material in it that that was available, you know, that had been in all these other versions, and try to make the sort of definitive, you know, kind of cut. I mean, there's always an issue with these things, you know, about what is the definitive cut, and there isn't really an answer, because, I mean, quite often, I think, in back in the day, these guys would... They would film the material, and then it would be edited in different territories in different ways, you know, to like if there was an actor that was popular in one territory, you might get more of them than in some of the others, you know. So the notion that there is one definitive final version of these films is always something that's a little bit of an open issue. But, right. we were pretty certain that we wanted to try it and put together something that was the fullest version that we could manage of this film. And I think we managed it, and it was good to be able to do that on Blu-ray, because obviously that's, you know, at the moment the best sort of quality you can get. So I think, you know, people who've got, hopefully, I mean, people who've got the DVD will now think, well, you know, maybe it's worth upgrading to this one, and I think it is, obviously.
Oh, yeah, totally.
It's a beautiful film, and that's, I think, what caught me off guard, because I'm used to seeing the kind of zombie movie Fulci. I get all these guys mixed up.
There's no way to get Fulci mixed up, Sean.
Well, no, these are the, you know. I want to say Blood and Black Lace was Fulci, wasn't it?
Nah, it's Mario Bava.
See, Bava, you know, but
well, the thing
once
with,
we get into kind of the giallo kind of territory, yeah, where this is somewhat considered giallo, but
yeah, it's in that area.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, it's the imagery and right, you know, and stuff like that. But this is this film was Fulci's like first step into kind of the horror psychological. Well, I mean, I haven't seen some of his films from the 60s, but as far as being kind of batshit crazy, this is one of the first films that I can remember Fulci doing before he actually got into horror. This is the film before he met Dardano Sacchietti, who completely changed his career, in my opinion, because yeah, Sacchietti, they met in, you know, 71 and started doing movies together right after this. You know, Torture of the Duckling, the Psychic came out, and that's when Fulci's career took a different toll. And I truly believe it's because of that screenwriter. You know,
I think you're right. I mean, although yeah, Fulci, you know, kind of began, had a long career and began as a writer for other people, mostly in comedies. He was kind of someone who was influenced by the people that he worked with, you know, the writers he worked with, and that guy definitely, you know, definitely had an effect, and I think took him, you know, more into the, you know, the kind of genre horror kind of stuff. And, so you get the zombie movies and all that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, a lot of people maybe were surprised when they see films like Lizard and the Psychic and so on, and see that, you know, he Fulci was, you know, was capable of subtlety, you know, which, mm-hmm, I mean, is the last thing you'd throw at some of the later films he made. I mean, great though they are, you know, they're pretty in your face, you know. And I think, you know, Lizard and so on is that it's in your face moments, but it's kind of quite a subtle film and with a lot of different layers in it.
Yeah, it was one of the films, because I grew up on 80s Fulci, you know. That's when I very first, you know, when I was a young kid, you know, Zombie was one of the very first things I saw. And then, you know, I saw, you know, The Beyond, Enigma, Touch of Death, House by the Cemetery, that kind of stuff. So eventually when I got a hold of one of the DVDs of this, I didn't know what to say because it didn't feel like what I was used to, you know. And it was before he went off the deep end making these crazy, you know, horror films. He had this, like, really this murder giallo psychological hypersexual movie that, you know, little old me was like, you know, too busy with my hands in my pants rather than actually paying attention to the movie.
But, you know, you're brutally honest.
It is a strong
one of those films, one of those films that actually, you know, stuck with me more than some of those others ones, because it's most memorable because it is such a weird film, even for Fulci. It's a weird film, but it's on a level also of, you know, it's not lost in translation like Manhattan Baby or something like that, where it's just absolutely fucking insane. It's something on lower key that, you know, kind of dives into the giallo. And even, like, you know, I feel like traces of, like, Edgar Allan Poe in the movie as well. Like, kind of just kind of that dark mystery horror storytelling.
Well, Fulci was a great reader. And, I mean, you know, he knew all the classic kind of horror stuff. And, you know, you definitely get bits of that coming out in all of his films, I think. But, I mean, obviously, he was a huge Hitchcock fan as well. And there's a lot of Hitchcock in this film. And, in fact, in the film he made before, which was called, title translates One on Top of the Other. Perversion Story, I think, is another title, which was filmed in America. It's filmed in San Francisco in homage to Vertigo, I guess, Hitchcock's Vertigo. And it's got kind of a similar kind of, you know, there's some similar elements. And so, you know, he was quite a cultured guy, I think, as a filmmaker, was Fulci. And I think, you know, that often gets kind of overlooked in some of his later films. You wouldn't necessarily see that, but it's definitely there in these ones.
Well, I'm interested in finding more of these films, his earlier films now, because I really loved the film. And it's, it is a mystery thriller, you know, where this housewife basically is, you know, accused of murder, and basically the investigation, you know, did she do it or didn't she do it, and everything. And
And did she do it in a dream and then it
right.
became reality? Yeah. You know, this kind of stuff.
I mean, the dream sequences are very Fulci with the, you know, the blowing hair, the fans, obviously.
The handheld cameras.
Yeah, I mean, there is definite Fulci touches to this. I mean, but the dream sequences, especially the one that it opens up with, is just, I mean, in more ways than one, just amazing.
Yes. It's an incredible way to open a film, actually. Yeah. And it's not really been beaten, I don't think.
And it's sexual in a way and very, like, erotic in a way, but not, I don't know, very, very artistic.
It's also kind of a genre. It's also, aside from comedy, it's a genre mashup, mm-hmm. too. I mean, yeah. there's a lot of, you know, traces of all genres in this film. And, you know, I think that's one thing that I think this is the film that changed Fulci and made him who he became in a way. Because, I mean, his other films, some of his Westerns, I consider iconic. But, you know, you could watch one of his Westerns and you could watch, you know, something like The Beyond or this, and you couldn't be able to put the two filmmakers together. There's not – like he kind of reinvented himself when he went into horror. You know, he made such a, you know, a huge impact. His whole career changed, and you know, he never really went back to kind of the old, you know, the old westerns and stuff. I think he had an action movie Contraband. That's really great. He went back to that, and you know, I think Conquest was a little batshit crazy. But other than that, I mean, he very much stayed true to horror, psychological horror, and you know, got the name the Godfather of Gore, right?
That's it. Yeah, although I guess Herschel Gordon Lewis would probably claim that one, wouldn't it? Or it would be claimed on his behalf, maybe. But I think, you know, like Fulci, like a lot of these Italian filmmakers worked in the commercial world, they had to switch genres because, you know, the public taste moved on. You know, like, you know, in the early 60s, you had the peplums, you know, the historical films, and you had the westerns, and then you had the gothic horrors. And the comedies and all that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, Fulci had to make what he was, you know, he was a hired hand in a sense, you know. So if a producer said to him, I want you to make this Edgar Allan Poe type film, he'd kind of go and do it, you know. But he definitely seemed to bring a lot of his own personality to bear in these films, the ones we're talking about. And I think, you know, in the sort of zombie films and so on, a particular side of his personality came out. I mean, you know, maybe he's rather more cynical side, you know. I think he was a very funny guy. I met him once many, many years ago, and he was a very funny guy, but very sort of cynical, you know, cynical sense of humour. And I think that's there in those zombie films. I mean, you wouldn't think of them as comedies, and they're not. But they do have this kind of particular, you know, kind of acerbic sort of view of humanity, which I think definitely comes out. I think that was definitely him.
Yeah, you know, as other – you said hired, you know, that's one thing because he did those White Fang movies with Nero.
Yeah.
Sure, but, you know, which
I think really it was after this too.
He really rated those films. You know, he said that they were – you know, he was very proud of those films. You know, I think technically they were well made. I mean, his films were – you know, he'd been working in films for a long, long time since the 50s. So, you know, he kind of knew how to do it. He knew what he was – you know, he knew how to get the things he wanted, you know. But I think the problem, probably for Fulci later on, was that he never really got the budgets that he wanted, you know. And I mean, Cat and Brain and stuff like that, you know, which is kind of quite fun, but it's definitely funny as well, you know, a very bleak kind of sense of humour. But I mean, I don't think, and it's a great idea, of course, but I don't think he ever really had the money to make those films the way that he would have made them, say, 10 years earlier. So you kind of feel that you're making allowances for some of those early films. And I don't think you have to make allowances at all for the, you know, certainly not for Lizard and for all of the films during that period. I mean, the one he made after, you know, Don't Talk to a Duckling, which you mentioned, which is, again, quite a large budget film, I think. And there's a, you know, it's a really brilliant film.
Well, there's a scene in Lizard in a Woman's Skin that I found subtle, but it was hilarious, where I think the inspector is talking to – I forget who he's talking to, but he's out of cigarettes. He's trying to get a cigarette.
Oh, yes.
He spots the cigarettes on the desk and just takes them without asking. And the looks exchanged are just classic, where the inspector gives no shits, you know, and the other guy's not going to challenge him on it. He's going to let it slide. But I thought that was hilarious. I can't remember exactly who he was talking to.
Well, it's funny because it's a guy. It's a guy called Basil Dignam the inspector, and I don't know if he's credited on the film. I mean, when I went through this film with Chris Gavin, who knows it very well and is very good on actors and so on. We were very interested to spot all these kinds of quite famous English character actors. Mm-hmm. Some of whom weren't even mentioned in the credits of the film, you know. And I think there is a kind of an issue of, and of course, Fulci started as a director of comedies, and I think he was able to bring these little things out of actors. If the actors were good enough and were on the same wavelength as him, which those guys definitely were, he could just put in a little look, as you're saying, exactly in that scene where the inspector looks up and you see this kind of look of sort of withering contempt, don't you, pass across his face. And of course Stanley Baker, you know, is obviously a really great actor as well, and he just completely ignores that look, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. He just carries on doing what he's doing. And do you remember in the same scene, they bring in a tray, someone brings in a tray of drinks,
right?
And there's a cup of tea or a cup of coffee and a whiskey, and the guy, whoever it is, brings the drinks and he puts them on the table with the whiskey towards the inspector, the Basil Dignam character, who very sort of angrily spins it round so that the whiskey is facing Stanley Baker. That's kind of, and that's one of the things I think that makes this film that lifts it. You know, makes it one of the reasons it's lasted is that there's all these kinds of things that you don't expect. All these little touches, you know, that just sort of bring it to life, and they bring the characters to life, and without those, it would still work as a film, but it wouldn't have this kind of resonance that it has, you know?
Yeah. Was this released as an English film? Because it seems like it wasn't, you know, a strict Italian film.
No, it was shot mostly in London.
Right.
That's another thing, because it's shot at that particular time. At the end of the 60s, very early 70s. So it's that kind of post swinging London kind of thing, you know, which was, you know, King's Road, Carnaby Street, all that stuff. Hippies and everything, which you get a little bit of in the film. So it's got very, very much in a particular time and a particular place. And the cast, of course, were mostly English, and they're definitely speaking English.
Mm-hmm.
And rarely for an Italian film, they actually dub their own voices. I mean, you probably know this, that mm-hmm. Italian films
yeah.
famously are shot without live sound, and the voices are all dubbed, even the Italian actors, even in the Italian films. And they're dubbed very, most often, they're not dubbed by the actual actors themselves. So you get this weird sort of disjunction, sort of alienation effect between the voice and the actor, which you get used to if you watch a lot of Italian films. Yeah. But in this one, that's Stanley Baker's voice. That is, you know, Basil Dignam's voice. That, you know, all the main actors there, that you can see that their lips are moving, you know, in the same way as the voice you're hearing. In other words, it's them speaking, and it's they're speaking their actual lines. You know, I mean, there's some that aren't. There's some of the Italian. Some of the smaller parts played by Italian actors probably didn't speak English and just do it in Italian, and that's dubbed, you know. But I think it was definitely conceived as a film that will be sold in as an English film, mm-hmm. and it will be sold in English language in America as it was, and it will be released in the UK and so on as a English film. And I guess maybe in some other territories, you know, still the same, actually, that a film in English language is easier to sell around the world than a film that which is, say, in Italian language or Spanish language. And I think that was the thinking, I think, of the production here, that let's make this film, shoot it in England, shoot it in London, and we will make it an English film. You know, we'll get a lot of English actors, because even some of the small parts, you know, some of the sort of bit characters are English, local English actors as well, you know, speaking English. So, you know, they really worked quite hard to make this work as an English language film.
And this one was released a little bit on the wider scale, because I think I was looking up earlier is that it was released by AIP that did a lot of they released a lot of films in between the 50s and 70s and 80s. I think they went out of business in the 80s.
Yes, yeah. It was acquired by MGM, I think.
Yeah, was this something – now, did you have any inclination of how well this did for audiences? Because I believe it was a wider release for something of this nature.
Yeah, in America, yeah, it came out a couple of titles. It was Schizoid, as we discussed earlier, and it was also A Lizard and a Woman's Skin. It was the two titles. And it got well reviewed. I mean, as far as we can see, it got reviewed in Variety and so on in the trade papers. And, you know, they said it was a pretty, you know, it was a quality production and so on. And it was a, you know, it was a thriller, Italian sort of style thriller and so on, but with some very, you know, well-known names in it. So I think it probably did well. I don't actually know what the box office figures for it were, but I think it did pretty well. And it was obviously released in France and Spain and on all around Europe and probably in the Far East as well. But I don't actually know.
I just like to know if this is one of Fulci's more bigger money makers other than Zombie.
I think it was.
It's kind of hard to find, you know, box office revenue, how well these films did. You know, because, I mean, it was easier to get films in theaters and stuff like that, especially, you know, 42nd Street, the Grindhouse theaters would play a lot of this stuff. So, yeah, I'm sure it's kind of hard to trace back because of all those small theaters. It's not like it is today.
I'm
curious.
I don't know how you would get those. I mean, you probably could find them somewhere, the box office figures, but... you know, there was no TV. Well, there was TV, obviously, but TV didn't play films like this. I mean, this film was definitely one you had to go and see in the cinema. And in the UK, it was rated X, which doesn't really mean sort of sex or anything, but it just means that it was for adults only. You know, you had to be over 16, I think it was at the time, to go and see this film. Yeah. So, you know, which would have kind of limited its audience, but also would have increased its audience in a funny kind of way, because people wanted to go and see something that was a little bit daring and something they knew wouldn't be on television. So, you know, going to the cinema was your major kind of form of entertainment in those days.
Yeah, I was always kind of curious of how many jobs like Fulci was offered after this film.
Well, he worked with... Yeah, sorry, go on.
No, it's just always... curiosity always peaks when you see something of this nature from a filmmaker so substantial and so different, exactly what came their way. You know, it's because interviews aren't by the dozens like they are today and learning exactly what their career took them, unless there's, you know, a documentary made or something like that. It was just Fulci had an odd career as a filmmaker. To me, it seems like he just jumped all over the place. But I think that's obviously by choice. He just got his hands into everything. And I would just like to know exactly what took him to this place in horror, just kind of doing horror from then on out, you know, didn't really look back at anything.
I think it was very producer led. I mean, he worked for the producer of Lizard, Amando Amati, who was quite a well-known Italian producer of, you know, fairly reasonably budgeted films. Fulci worked for him a few times. And I think, you know, that was the kind of way it worked. You know, particularly in Italy, there would be producers who specialized in a particular kind of area and could raise money for certain kinds of projects. And, you know, I think most of those zombie films were produced by the same, you know, the same companies, the same individuals. And I think it was that kind of thing. And, you know, they would say, oh, Fulci, he's a good pair of hands. We can trust him. We know that if we give him this much money, he's going to come back with a film that's professional and that we can sell in all these particular territories and we'll get our money back. You know, so I think that was the way it worked. I mean, he wasn't an auteur in the sense that he was, you know, like, I would think of someone today, you know, like, you know, Wes Anderson or whatever, you know, someone who obviously has an idea, I'm going to make this film, and then they'll go out and try and raise the money and get the cast and all the rest of it. I think Fulci was pretty much, he would get to know a particular producer and that guy would say, okay, I want a horror film, you know, go out and make it, that kind of thing. It was much more a commercial transaction, if you like. And obviously he tried to bring his own personality and his own kind of ideas and his own approach into those films. And obviously in the really good ones, he did that because, you know, we can see a distinctive, you know, kind of Fulci touch. But as you say, it does change as he gets, you know, into the zombie films and so on. They become much more kind of visceral, you know, much more in your face. Yeah. But I mean, there are touches of that, you know, in Lizard. I mean, there's that scene, there's a couple of scenes, you know, where there's one scene in one of the, sort of dream kind of things, you know, where there's a sort of murder scene and you see some, you know, someone with their sort of guts kind of spilling out all over the screen. You remember that?
Well, that dog scene, you know.
And then there's the dog scene, yeah, which, you know, we could talk about, because that's kind of, because, you know, that's really shocking, and it's shocking
that's
now.
That's missing from one of the DVD releases I had.
Yes.
Like, I think when I very first saw that scene wasn't, you know, integrated in the film, and I think it was when Image released it on DVD is when I very first saw it, and I was like, "Holy shit! Like, that's pretty intense."
There were some issues with the in the UK with you know, animal cruelty or whatever. They had to go to court or something like that.
That was in Italy, actually.
In Italy, okay.
I believe he when the film was originally released, there were complaints, there was legal charges saying that. That he'd actually killed these dogs, you know, and sort of cut them up and so on. And I have to say that, you know, you look at it now and it is pretty realistic, you know, and
there's a couple of dogs that do look legit. Like, it looks
really, they're not, though. They're yeah, they were made by Carlo Rambaldi, I believe. You know, it was the guy who did the special effects for E.T. many years later.
Yeah. Wow.
And he was a real master of special physical effects. And he had to go to court, you know, with one of these fake dogs and show how he'd done it, because, you know, Fulci was in danger of going to prison because the effects were so lifelike, so realistic. I mean, in the UK, I don't know. I imagine that scene would have been cut. I think that scene would have been cut, and probably before the film was even submitted for classification. You know, the distributor would have said, "Hey, we'll never get this one through. Cut that scene out."
Well, I'm wondering if that's how these different prints, you know, ended up. You know, different edited prints.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely part of it. You know, and I mean, that scene is really weird. That dog scene, because in the film, obviously, we don't want to give too much away because there's people, you know, maybe haven't seen it yet. You know. But there's these levels, you know, where there's a kind of an obvious reality, you know, there's people walking down the street and getting on the bus and all that stuff. And then there's the dream sequences, you know, which the film opens with, and those ones are kind of midway between fantasy and reality. And then there's scenes like this, the dog one, where she's in a hospital, you know, after having had a sort of breakdown, and she kind of discovers this weird laboratory where these dogs are, you know, this dog scene is taking place, this strange operation is going on. And that's kind of presented as reality in the film, that she's actually seen this, you know, that she's not going mad or that it's not a dream or a fantasy, which is kind of really strange. I mean, you know, what? I don't know what was in his head when he came up with that. It's just bizarre.
Yeah,
that's faulty, though.
Yeah,
exactly. That's one of the things that, you know, why this film, you know, people are saying, "Oh, why has this film lasted so many years?" And I think that's the reason why, because it's there's so many questions, you know, that it poses, and you sort of watch it and you think about it afterwards and you think, what was that all about? You know, and it's so well done that you don't just dismiss it and say, "Oh, well, who cares? You know, it was just silly." But, you know, you want to sort of try and solve the enigma of what these scenes mean, what this film is about. And I think, you know, that's the reason why that's the reason why people are still talking about it today, which is like, what, 40, how many years is it? 1971? How many years is that? 45 years? A long time. Anyway, it's a long time ago when this film was made, but we're still talking about it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, like I said before, it's substantial. And plus, you know, this is one of, I think Marcone worked with Argento in before this, but this is also another film that kicked off kind of Morricone's career into horror soundtracks, because he was so used to the drama and Western films that this kicked it off his career.
And this soundtrack's more of a jazzy type score, correct?
Well, that's kind of how he was, because I think he did the soundtrack to I can't remember the names now, but kind of the Cat O' Nine Tails he did the Fifth Chord and stuff like that, and you know, Four Flies on Grey Velvet is very jazzy as well, because it's kind of the giallo feel was kind of the jazz synth type thing that was happening. But you know, this is another thing where Morricone just started working with Fulci on films, and of course with Argento. So I think this is another film that kind of kicked off his career even more into that direction. which I always thought was interesting.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and it's one of Morricone's best, I think it's one of his best scores. It's, you know, it's got all those beautiful tunes and everything. And then you've got all these weird, you know, kinds of sort of jazzy things, and then this kind of avant-garde stuff, you know, going on at the same time. And it's, you know, you can sort of listen to that score. I mean, you can do that with most of his scores, but you can listen to that score as a kind of piece of music, and it, without the film, and it's a great piece of music, but it's even better with the film, you know. Mm-hmm. It really adds another sort of dimension to it, you know. And I think there was, you know, at the time, I think there was a certain rivalry between Argento and Fulci, who obviously knew each other. You know, that maybe, hey, I'm gonna borrow your composer, or you're borrowing my composer, or, you know, hey, that scene, you know, with the bats, you know, that's like something I would have done, you know, that kind of thing. And I think, there was a kind of a rivalry between those two guys as to who was the king of, you know, who was the actual king of Italian horror at the time, you know. And I think, you know, maybe that's, you know, the Morricone stuff comes into that and comes into play there.
Yeah, I think some of his scores after this, especially, you know, because one of my favorite Giallo films and one of the most intense scenes ever is, I think, the Fifth Chord, especially in that hallway with that guy creeping up with those gloves. I still that scene still like gives me the shivers, because I saw that at such a young age and it scared me. And it was, you know, not too many things scared me, because I was so desensitized at such a young age. When I saw that, I was like, what the fuck? But, yeah.
And your life was never the same again.
No. Well, it turned me on to so much, though, you know, because that was one of the titles that there was sitting at the video store on VHS, and it was just one of those things that I happened to grab. And, you know, plus, you know, there's a lot of sexy time in that movie, too. But it was just one of those things where, you know, it really got me into Morricone, because he just – all those Giallo films that he would score afterwards, I think that's what really kicked off kind of the Giallo-esque films in the 70s with, you know, like I said, The Fifth Chord, Black Belly of the Tarantula. I mean, he did Four Flies on Grey Velvet, My Dear Killer, just Cold Eyes of Fear, just all those films that had such a big, big impact with Italian cinema that I think amplified everything. The filmmakers themselves, I think they got even more excited when they had Morricone on, just because they knew that, just, you know, you have, you know, Fulci and Argento both, they had the visuals, they had the great camera work, they had great lighting, and that's, you know, all those things are good, but sometimes music can make that scene be 10 times, 100 times better. I mean, you can just do that with any Carpenter film. Take the soundtrack out of any Carpenter film, and it's just, it doesn't have the same effect.
He knew
his music, and the directors, I bet that was a big bidding war for Morricone too, because everybody probably wanted him, because he was changing movies himself just through his music.
Yeah, he was busy, wasn't he? I mean, I suppose he was like Bernard Herrmann was to Hitchcock, you know. It's you put him and the score together, you know, and it's a package, you know. And of course Fulci, you know, had a background in music. I mean, he was a music critic, and he wrote songs and stuff, you know, and he was a big lover of modern jazz and stuff. So, you know, I think it must have been probably a very happy working relationship with those two guys. And I absolutely agree with you about the impact of music on films generally, but certainly on these kinds of films, because they're largely about atmosphere, aren't they, to an extent, rather than straightforward plot. And I think that kind of music adds this kind of an element of, you know, very strong atmospheric kind of element to what's happening on screen. And I mean, there's whole sequences in Lizard, like, for example, the one in the Alexandra Palace, you know, the one where they got the bats, you know, where she's attacked by the bats and everything.
Yeah.
And she's stalked by this guy, you know, with a knife and everything. That whole sequence, I don't know how long it is, but it's quite long, and there's no dialogue in it at all. It's just sound effects, music, and very clever, you know, kind of filming, very, very skillful camera work and stuff. And, you know, in other words, pure cinema. And I think that's what people like Fulci were aiming for. It's pure cinema. You know, you don't really need a plot. You don't need dialogue. You need actors, and you need a location and atmosphere, and music is a major part of that.
I think maybe Fulci took that a little too much to heart.
In some cases, I absolutely agree. But you know, it's really funny because years ago we interviewed Luigi Cozzi, you know, who worked with you know, Argento and so on. And he said this, and it was, this would have been in the 90s, I guess, you know, and we were talking about Italian genre films and stuff, and he, and we mentioned Fulci, obviously, and he said, okay, people laugh at Fulci and so on, but, you know, in a way, filmmakers like Steven Spielberg with things like Jurassic Park, you know, he said Jurassic Park, this is what Luigi Cozzi said, Jurassic Park is like a, it's like a Fulci film that made with millions of dollars. And at the time, I thought, he's crazy. But afterwards, he's right. Because in a sense, something like Jurassic Park is a series of set pieces, isn't it? And you know, high tension set pieces. And in a sense,
yeah, it's just a bunch of scenes.
Yeah, that's what Fulci was working towards, you know, a series of high tension set pieces that have some kind of a thin story that brings them together. But the whole point about it is to create that effect on the screen, you know, and to move the audience and to scare them and so on. So I think there's a big similarity there between Fulci and a lot of what came later.
Wow.
Well, I think he inspired, you know, a ton of people, too, with that, because I think, you know, I love Italian cinema, huge, I adore it more than probably the American cinema. It's just, I've always enjoyed the visuals and the tension. The movies might not be as good, you know, and some of them aren't, but there's very effective scenes, and along with the music and lighting and all that stuff, that's kind of my favorite. It's just, it's like watching fireworks to me. Well, better than fireworks. Fireworks are kind of boring. But, you know, it's just that, you know, you have the loud noises, you have the pops, you jump, and that's kind of what watching some of these films was like. I mean, even Lado? He made a film, Who Saw Her Die? Yeah. And it's just, in Morricone used that one fucking, like, it's so, like, it drives me crazy because it's just so good, where he just has all those children in the choir just, you know, doing the la 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 la.
Yeah.
And well, it just so fucking terrifying because it's played so loud throughout the film, and you're watching kind of that, you know, that black dress of death come across the film, and just like out in broad daylight. And that's the thing, is the film's, you know, shot in mostly daytime. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of these films were at night, and when the horror starts happening at the daytime, it takes it to a new level. Yes. You know, and then you saw that happen with a lot of the Italian filmmakers, is the horror started happening during the day. Like, what the fuck are you supposed to do at night? Like, it's fucking terrifying. I mean, Zombie takes place mostly during the day.
Yeah, well, you just don't go out at night, do you? This is, but yeah. I mean, the thing is that these things are very operatic, aren't they? And I think, you know, we've got to remember that the Italians, you know, kind of perfected in the 19th century. You know, grand opera was one of the things that they were, you know, they were very good at. And I think, you know, some of these filmmakers, you can overmake this point, but I think it's definitely true that the filmmakers we're talking about, they were in that operatic tradition, weren't they? Where it was a lot of sort of sound and fury and, you know, kind of a spectacle. You know, is what they were after, really.
Well, I noticed that even with just some of the set pieces, like there's a scene where the two gentlemen are walking away from a mansion, like walking dogs, and from this manor, the framing is just, you know, there are these specks among this, you know, huge background of this mansion, and then more of an estate, I guess. But then there's another scene where she's up on that chase on the rooftop, but she's running from that one of the.
Yeah, that's the one we were – the end of the scene we were talking about.
Yeah, and that – those shots are just, you know, so cinematic. You don't – I feel like you don't see a whole lot of that, filmmakers today taking the time to really set up, you know, that kind of shot.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's an amazing shot, isn't it, on the roof,
Yeah, it's like what I always say, because Sean and I have discussed Italian cinema. You know, it's always one thing that you hear is like, you know, I understand the movies maybe aren't that great, and it always frustrates me when people are like, oh, the Italian movies, they're dubbed, they're not, you know, they're not very good, it's lost in translation stuff. I was like, yeah, but you got to look at the visuals. Like, these are the movies that inspire people. is I want my movie to look like this.
Yeah.
You know, you have storytelling. Yeah, all that comes, you know, with a good writer, good musician. But to actually set up, like, scenes just with, you know, the hypersexual scenes with the girls in the bed. Like, you know, they just didn't film. They didn't go to somebody's bedroom and, you know, film on a bed. No, Fulci and the lighting guy and, you know, the set decorator handpicked those sheets. They handpicked everything for that room.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and that, they made it just extraordinary.
That must have been fun, huh?
Well, it's like, you know, you can tell Fulci, he takes the time in order, you know, to tell stories. And one thing that I always connected with, and this is a bizarre, you know, putting two people together, but Fulci feels like, you know, Pedro Almodovar, I feel he took a lot of stuff from Fulci films. It might not be there because he's never really done horror in a way, but Pedro Almodovar is exactly the same way. He tells his story through, you know, visuals, through lighting, through set decorations, through colors. You know, you can even – there's foreshadowing of characters just by what they're wearing.
Yes,
in these films. And I think that's a different method and different level of filmmaking that we don't really have much anymore. And that's why I always kind of stand up for these films. So if you ever want – watch a fucking – you know, watch – A Lizard in a Woman's Skin, and then watch like Broken Embraces from Almodovar, and you'll see these like stunning just visuals from both of these filmmakers.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think in a film like Matador, for example, you know, Almodovar is very influenced by you know, kind of genre cinema, horror cinema, and I think it's that's the film I'm thinking of at the beginning. There's a sort of a montage of scenes, including clips from Jess Franco films and so on. You remember that scene? And I think he's definitely, obviously, he's very much aware of these kinds of things. And also maybe it's that, you know, without going too far down this, maybe it's the sort of Latin temperament or something. You know, they're more, you know, things are more extreme there. You know, the weather is more extreme and the, you know, and life is just more kind of, you know, loud and everything, you know, and I guess that influences the films. You know, I mean, if you look at sort of new films that come out of New York, you know, they've got a very particular flavor, haven't they? And films that come out of Los Angeles or films that come out of San Francisco, you know, have got a very different flavor from the ones that come out of Los Angeles. You know, I mean, it's definitely part of the, you know, part of the deal, I think, you know, where you come from. And I think that that what you're talking about, that flavor of the Italian cinema is definitely something that, of the Italian genre cinema anyway, is definitely something that you know, if you've got any, you know, kind of sympathy for it at all, you know, that's what you identify with. And when you watch these films, and no matter that the plot doesn't make any sense and that the dubbing is not very good and so on, you're sort of drawn into the atmosphere of those films, aren't you? And it's a very particular place that you're inhabiting.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's always something that'll stand out for sure.
Yeah.
In these films.
Well, you just get sucked in, don't you? You know, it's like, you know, you find yourself in this kind of world, you know, and the logic of it is the logic of, you know, they're presenting to you, and you don't sort of question it, and you just go along with it, and you enjoy the ride. This is the thing, isn't it? You know, it's like, you know, it's like a roller coaster ride. You know, you're taken away, and you can't stop it. You know, it's drawing you on. You know, that's what you want.
Well, that's the thing about, you know, Lizard is that it's a very – it is a simple kind of detective murder mystery, you know. But the way that Fulci frames everything just adds so much more to the film, I think, that would – say if a different director took this script, you know, and made their own film, or someone, you know, did a remake off the same script, a la Cabin Fever – say if somebody took that, I don't think it would be as operatic or as grand. It would definitely be smaller scale because people would treat it differently than Fulci treated this film. And it's the same thing with all these as I'm starting to discover these more of these giallo films. I mean, I haven't watched a whole lot. I've watched kind of the heavy hitters, but diving into things like this, you know, where you always think of giallo like, oh, it's a black glove with a knife, you know, stalking, you know, beautiful women is the, I guess, the standard.
That's pretty much it.
You know, but this is not that at all. But it's still considered.
No.
But it's because it's a thriller.
Yeah, and,
you know.
I mean, I think the explanation of giallo goes a long way with cinema, because I think it gets that black glove killer, you know, mentality. People think of that automatically, but I think giallo is a lot more than that. Yeah. Well, I mean, we have like, you know, the, you know, Bava making kind of giallo-esque films in you know, the late 60s, mm-hmm. and then, you know, so we had some more stuff in the 70s, but I think it's more or less, you know, if people go back to the original, you know, how the origins, how it started with the books, you know, the yellow book, you know, little paperbacks into the murder mm-hmm. mysteries. But I mean, I think it turned into a style of filmmaking. I don't necessarily think when I hear giallo, I think black glove killer. I mean, I do think that, but I also think of stuff like Suspiria, for example. I mean, there's an argument that Suspiria isn't a giallo film, which I think it is, mainly because of the music and the visual that Argento does. I mean, I don't think that it's that standard, you know, like something like The Fifth Chord or like Four Flies on Grey Velvet, where it's, you know, the murder mystery with the gloves, you know, or Cat of Nine Tails or anything of that nature. I think it's all about presentation. And, you know, it's why I would love to see giallo come back. And it slowly has a little by little. But I think it's just kind of method of filmmaking that I truly love because, like Pete said, it's very operatic. Like, you get to watch a film presented to you that you normally don't get to see. And that's what, you know, visualization of those films, that's what excites me more than kind of an intricate story or of a whodunit. Mm-hmm. It's more or less, you can tell a very basic movie, but like, it's grand what these guys are doing. So,
and these things are very much of a time and a place, aren't they? And I think it's very difficult to recreate that. And I think one of the things that's appealing about them is the fact that they are from a, you know, a distant time and place. And as I say, they take you on this kind of journey. And you know, modern films that you know, that attempt, and some of them quite cleverly, to follow in that style, they can never really do it, because, you know, what you actually need is a time machine, and you need to go back to, you know, 1971 or something. And
well, there's a lot of things kind of colliding around that point, like you said, with the end of the kind of the swinging 60s. I mean, we don't have things like that where these those types of swingers parties were, you know, very common.
they still are around.
Well, probably, but I mean, they're very you see these in these films where it's very lavish, and, you know, I mean, me going through college and everything like that, I would have killed for a party like that. you know, but it always ended up, I was in the middle of Iowa, but it was just a bunch of, idiots drinking, natural light and doing shots of lime vodka and passing out, pretty much.
That sounds pretty good to me.
But there was a lot of different cultures, I think, colliding at this time. I think more there's still, I mean, that's the thing. Every generation has its cultures colliding. It's just around this time it was different. You know, art was expressing that differently, you know, than we have now.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think, you know, it was a time of change, wasn't it? You know, and I mean, as we, you know, we talk about in some of the extras on the disc, you know, this was a period of transition, and it was a period when, you know, the optimism maybe of the 60s was turning a bit sour. And so the film has a kind of a, you know, kind of a pretty sort of negative take on some of those things. You know, it's not positive about, you know, things like drugs and, you know, psychedelia and so on. I mean, they're seen as being, you know, kinds of, you know, problems and things that may be, you know, are not particularly helpful, you know, because I think Fulci was definitely started off when he was a young man anyway. He certainly says this, that he started off, you know, with sort of political ambition, not political ambitions, but he was a lefty, you know. And he thought the society could change for the better and so on. But I think by the time he made Lizard, and certainly his later films, he'd given up on that. And he thought, well, you know, man is cruel and rotten and horrible, and there's nothing we can do about it, you know, so I'm just going to go out and make films about it, you know, this kind of thing. I think
the optimism was gone.
It was gone. And I think, you know, this film, and I think maybe Don't Torture a Duckling and so on, are the sort of points around which it changed for him, you know, which his approach to you know, the world and politics maybe changed.
Yeah. What I love about this disc here is just the amount of special features you have in there. I was kind of going through them the other day, and you have, I mean, there's almost 2 hours of special features on here.
Oh, wow.
Right? Is that right? We got the interview.
I don't know. I mean, that's amazing. That's true. Yeah,
I've been watching a lot of movies, so I want to make sure I'm not getting them confused with another thing. But I wrote down a point about this one because there's the Shedding the Skin documentary. There's the Lucio Fulci's Day for Night, an actual interview with him, which is fantastic. And you got an interview with Stephen Thrower, and then an interview with actor Tony Adams, and those kind of go on for a while. And then there's this audio commentary with Chris Gavin.
Yes, well.
I mean, there's just this thing's loaded, and I only scratched the surface. I couldn't really finish them all.
That was good. That was what we wanted. I mean, we wanted to present, you know, as full a meal as, you know, a banquet as we could get on there, you know, because I'm particularly pleased that you liked the Day for Night piece, because that it took quite a bit of getting that sorted out. But I really wanted an interview with Fulci, because I kind of thought that there aren't enough interviews with him available. And, you know, I wanted something that, you know, it's easy to get people to talk about Fulci, or it's relatively easy to get people to talk about Fulci. But I thought, let's try and find something where he presents himself and presents himself in the way that I remembered him, remembered from having met him all those years ago.
Where did you guys find that?
Well, it was done for Italian TV, and I saw it first on a French DVD that came out 10 years or so ago. That was it, really. I mean, I just kind of remembered it. And there's not that many interviews with Fulci. I mean, he did a few, you know, sort of bitty ones, and he did some later on in his life when he was perhaps not, you know, very well, and maybe he didn't come across, you know, the way that he actually was. I think in that interview, he comes across, you know, as a very sort of funny guy. You know, he's got a very dry sense of humor, and he's very aware of what he does, and you know, and he's proud of what he does, and so on. And but he's realistic about it, and you know, and I think that was the picture I wanted to present. I want to say, here's the guy that made the movie, you know, and it adds another level to it, I think.
Is fantastic, and I don't think I'd ever seen an interview with Fulci, so I was very surprised at how just approachable of a guy he seemed to have been.
You know, it's interesting, because in that interview was done by a woman, female director, and I think he was different. You know, with women. In fact, I know he was different with women from what he was with guys. Particularly, you know, if they were sort of fans of his, he would treat them kind of quite mean sometimes, you know. And I think it was a woman, he was a bit more respectful, and he wanted to kind of get her on his side, you know, so he was kind of being nice to her, you know. So he was saying things that he probably wouldn't have said to a guy, is what I'm saying, you know, that he opened up a little bit more because it was a woman asking the questions.
Now, about picking, like, how long were you working on getting this actually released?
Long time.
Yeah.
It was a long time. And because we wanted to, you know, make this the longest version or the most complete version, and also do it in HD, we needed to find some sequences that were missing. And that was a really, really, really difficult thing to do. I thought it would be – well, I didn't think it would be easy, but I thought it would be relatively easy. I thought this is a film that was distributed in a number of major territories. So we will find a print somewhere, a 35mm print, but we could not find a print anywhere. And there was a lot of kind of strange, you know, funny stories. Like there's a group in the UK who show films in sort of late night cinemas and things like this, yeah? And they're sort of big events, you know, people come along and there's a whole kind of party atmosphere. And I noticed that they'd screened this film. So I got in touch with, I vaguely knew the guys, I got in touch with them and said, can we access your print of Lizard in a Woman's Skin? And the guy kind of went quiet and he said, ah, that was a disaster. And I was like, why, what happened? And apparently, you know, we said that this film was released in America as Schizoid. He found a film storage place that said that they had a copy of Lizard in a Woman's Skin, but it was called Schizoid. So he booked it, advertised it, booked the cinema, it was a late night screening, like 11:30, midnight, something. All these people came along very excited to see A Lizard in a Woman's Skin. But what they actually got was this film Schizoid, this American movie. And apparently, you know, it was a disaster because, you know, obviously people were massively annoyed by having turned up to see this. So you know, it's just started this long, long search to find this. And there was a print in Italy and it had gone missing. And I had a guy who was helping us out in Italy. And it took, you know, he was going up and down Italy. He was driving up and down the motorway, going to different places where he thought this print might have been lost. And it was just crazy, you know. So that was kind of, that took a long time, just doing that. I mean, just looking for those missing bits, I reckon, took about 6 weeks, you know, from start to finish. Wow. So it did take a long time to put together. And obviously, you know, when you're working on these things, you're doing other things, you know, you're doing other projects as well, you know, so, you know, you have to keep, and also, you know, when the materials were delivered to us from the, lab, there was no soundtrack, you know, the soundtrack came separately, you know, so we had to sort of sync that up, you know, and it was, and there was bits missing from the soundtrack. And so it was a real kind of, I would say that this was the most complicated one that we've ever done. In fact, it's definitely the most complicated one we've ever done. So,
you hear that, people, so buy it. So that way it pays off.
What's that?
I said to tell people just to buy it because it will pay off.
Well, so. I'm really pleased that people have been, have responded so well because, you know, that was, obviously, that's your aim, isn't it? You know, when you do something, you hope people are going to like it, but you never know. You know, there's always a thing where it just doesn't work, or you know, people just don't respond. You know, so I'm really, you know, really pleased that people have liked this and that they've, you know, kind of seen all the work that we put into it. You know, because like with the audio commentary with Chris, you know, that I've known Chris a long time, and I knew that he knew a lot about this film, and I was talking to him one evening about it, having a coffee or something, and he was sort of telling me all these stories about the cast, and I said, look, you know, we've got to do an audio commentary, you know, you can't cover this in a short interview, you know, we've got to, you know, have you saying this stuff as the film plays and various people come up, you know, and you can tell us who they are and, you know, what we know about them and so on, and that adds sort of another level to it, and I think that's, you know, kind of that was really nice to do because I was discovering, you know, stuff for myself, and I think when you do these kinds of projects, that's really one of the main reasons for doing it, is that you're discovering something that is of interest to you.
Mm-hmm.
If I was just doing it because, oh God, I can't think of anything else to do, then it wouldn't be the same, you know. But you were actually discovering something new about this film as you progress, you know, on the project. And I think that's that was a really great thing. That in itself would have been a reward enough, you know, just to do that. But the fact that, you know, people have responded positively, I think is the icing on the cake. You know, that's perfect.
Do you have any other Fulci titles that you love that you would like to see? This is through Studio Canal, too, that popped up. So is there potential with working with them in the future?
Not really. I mean, the materials came from them, but the rights came from someone else. The rights came from somewhere else.
Mm. Oh, okay.
There's a couple of other Fulci things that we're talking about. I can't say what they are at the moment because, you know, it's, you know... sub judice and all that stuff, but yeah, there's a couple of things. I mean, there's still a number of his films that haven't really come out in you know, really decent versions. Mm-hmm. And you know, I hope that I mean, obviously we can't do them all, but we're looking at a couple of them at the moment. Yeah,
I would like to see For the Apocalypse. That's probably one of my favorite Fulci films, and it's just kind of crazy. Right. It's a Western serial killer type thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I know the film. Yeah, he did a couple of very brutal sort of westerns, didn't he? I mean, you know, I think it was a genre that, like, it was one of the ones that he really kind of brought something special to.
Yeah, and, Massacre Time was
Massacre
the other
Time.
One that,
yeah, absolutely. Which again is pretty brutal, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Even like, I mean, because it was, you know, we had all these, you know, John Wayne, you know, Sergio Leone spaghetti westerns coming out. But then you had this really gritty side of Westerns that were coming out as well from the Italians. You know, I mean, it's Leone was Italian and all that, but he, a more grittier, low-budget side. And a different method of storytelling, which is a lot more exciting. Because, I mean, we have, like, you know, the, you know, nothing wrong with the Leone films or anything like that. I mean, they're great films all around. But I do like kind of the underground Western thing that was happening with some of these smaller guys. And they were making some pretty brutal, you know, Westerns for the 60s. And Fulci was definitely one of them.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess he came in with that at the sort of, you know, the tail end of the Western movement, didn't he? You know, his films were made in the towards the end of the '60s, I suppose. Was it Massacre Time?
Massacre Time was in 66, I think.
Okay. So sort of in the middle, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder what
before the apocalypse was 75.
Yeah, that was later on. I was trying to think of the other one. It's like Light the Fuse and Here Comes Satan or something like that. It's something along the line, or Light the Stick of Dynamite, Here Comes Satan. Is it something like, you know what I'm talking about, Peter? Is that?
I'm not that familiar with that.
Something along the lines of that title. And that's another one that's always kind of stuck out to me.
I'd have to look that up to just.
I haven't seen it in years. It just popped in my head when we were talking about it. It was.
I certainly know Massacre Time and Four of the Apocalypse. And I wasn't.
Some of these are actually. I'm looking. I brought up IMDb, and some of these are in Italian. So I'm like, I don't know.
I'll email you the title. You definitely need to check it because it's really, really, really good.
Yeah, it's gonna drive you crazy.
Yeah.
It will drive me crazy. I'm going to be thinking about it the whole time. So we need to talk about something else.
Well, we probably can wrap up here. But is there anything coming down the pipes from Mondo Macabre that we should be keeping our eyes on that you can actually talk about?
We've got Symptoms coming up pretty soon, which is a project we're doing with in partnership with the BFI, with the British Film Institute here in the UK. We're doing the American one. They're doing the UK one. And this, I don't know if you know the film, but this is a film by a guy called José Larraz, who was a Spanish filmmaker, but he lived in the UK for much of his life. And it was released, I think, or it was made, I think, in 1974. And it was actually the British official entry at the Cannes Film Festival, amazingly, because it was a very small film, very low-budget film. And then it sort of disappeared. And it's got a reputation, you know, from, you know, one of these underground reputations, because it is a very – it's a quiet film, it's a small film, but it's a very spooky film. I mean, it takes place more or less in one house with a very small cast, mostly just two women. And it's got this really great atmosphere, really kind of moody and spooky atmosphere. And that's been a film that we've been working on one way and another for a long, long time. I mean, I knew José Larraz. He died, I think, two or three years ago. I knew him when he lived in the UK. And this was always a film that, you know, we wanted to kind of resurrect. And it just turned out to be like one of these long, you know, voyages when you're kind of looking for things, because the film had disappeared. Yeah, you know, the negative had vanished and everything. And it was a long. I mean, you know, I could probably talk an hour about that, you know, but I won't.
We'll have you back on.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's coming out in a couple of months, and we've got a film called a Greek film called Medusa. Obviously, the Medusa is a famous legend in Greece, you know, about the, you know, the woman with the snakes in her hair and so on, you know, and you, you know, if you look at her, you get turned to stone. And this is a modern kind of version of that. It's kind of more of a film noir than it's not a mythical kind of, you know, film set in the past. It's a modern. Well, I mean, I think it was made in the 90s. So it's a kind of a modern take on the Medusa myth, and it's one of the things that we try to do. I hope we succeed occasionally is to find things that haven't been really overexposed and that aren't really known about. Films from countries where you know, people don't expect horror movies to come from, for example. And I think Greece is one of those countries. And so we've got Medusa coming out, and it's a really interesting film. And the guy that made it is really interesting as well. I mean, there's an interview with him on the disc. And, you know, it's his story about how he came to make this film, and, you know, his background is kind of different from what you might expect. You know, so that was a really nice, you know, kind of discovery. And
who's the director of that?
It's a guy called George Lazopoulos, but he's never really directed anything else.
I'm trying to pull this movie up, and I'm like, I can't find it.
it's Medusa. It's Medusa.
Okay, I'm spelling it wrong then.
Yeah.
There it is, 1998. Okay.
There you go.
All right.
And it's
1998.
Yeah. For us, that's like yesterday, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say that's one of the more current, I mean, other than The Devil's Business, but yeah, that's one of the more current ones, right?
Yeah. It is, yeah. I mean, it just so happened. As you know, we were looking at we've put out a couple of Greek films, which I think you guys weren't too keen on.
Yeah, I wasn't. Yeah, I got a little remarks from that. I was just
Brad?
Well, The Wife Killer and Tango of Perversion. It was,
okay.
I was not a fan of The Wife Killer at all. Tango of Perversion wasn't that bad, but yeah, I was not happy with The Wife Killer. Like, it was surprising because I mean, usually that stuff's my speed. It just didn't hit me in the way that most of those films do. So
it's pretty grim.
Yeah.
So, so we won't talk about that one.
We call it like it is. We want to speak our feelings here.
Absolutely. Look, it's way, way better. Obviously, you know, we don't make these films particularly, but it's way, way better that people respond in a strong way to what we do. If people just go, that's okay, I guess, you know, so what? No, move on. Next. It's much better that somebody really reacts strongly, whether it's for or against, you know, that's really good, you know, and I'm happy with that.
Yeah, people want to know what you're talking about, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I read what you wrote, and you had your reasons. You know, it was like, I mean, that film actually did get quite a lot of negative reviews. And some of them, it was just like, I couldn't understand why. But at least, you know, you had a reasoned kind of argument. And, you know, that's kind of interesting to read as well, you know.
Please everybody. What are you gonna do?
No, that's right.
Hey, you please me like 98% of the time. I can have that one movie I don't like.
that's a pretty good record, isn't it? And we've got this film called Spider, or the title translates as The Spider, and it's from Latvia. You know, with which, you know, obviously formerly, you know, part of the Soviet Union.
Right.
And this is a film I think from the early 90s. And it's the first and I think the only horror film to be made in Latvia.
I think they had one a couple years ago.
Yes, there was one about the man in orange or something.
Yeah, right? the man in the orange jacket.
Go on, sorry, you were saying.
No, I was going to say it was a very, very bizarre movie, very, very slow. But it's funny because I saw it a few years ago. And it just got released on VOD on like Vudu and stuff over here. Oh. I don't recommend it. It's just it's not a very good movie, but it's interesting.
No, I know the film. Yeah, that you're right. That's probably the other one, but this was definitely the first.
And it's
a really interesting film, and it's kind of very much in the style of you know, Argento and so on. It's kind of got that Euro, you know, kind of mood. And it's about a girl who is hired as a model for a famous artist who wants to paint the Virgin Mary. And she's younger, she's 17 or 18, I think. And she starts to have these weird dreams about this kind of giant spider that's coming to her in the night and stuff. You know, I won't say it, I won't go on anymore. You can guess the rest. But it's very sort of gothic and very, you know, kind of nightmarish. And really
sounds right up my alley.
Yeah, it's really surprising, and it's really nicely done. And the guy that we got an interview with, the guy who made it, who directed it, who never made another film. This was his first and only film, but he was a production designer. And I think this film came out at a time when the Soviet Union, you know, was kind of collapsing, and all these independent states were, you know, were kind of were breaking away, and so a lot of unusual kind of cinema was being produced at that time. You know, the barriers were down, and you know, it was kind of anything goes, you know. And so, you know, that's you know, it's a film that kind of, for us anyway, came out of nowhere. You know, it was like I didn't expect to find this film, because no. You know, horror movies in the Soviet Union were not really, I mean, there are some, but they were not really accepted. You know, they weren't accepted as a legitimate form of expression. So it was quite unusual to find this kind of things coming out of that background, and for it to be good as well, which it is. It's really good.
Well, from what I've read, there is a scene that kind of is similar to a famous scene in Possession. And also a famous scene in Galaxy of Terror, but involving a spider.
Yes, that's right. Yes, there is. It's very much Possession. And I guess, you know, they must have seen Possession or something, probably.
Uh-huh.
But it's one of those things that is very much, you know, in and of itself, if you know what I mean. It just seems to exist because they wanted it to, rather than because they were trying to be like anything else. I mean, he does say that he was influenced by European horror movies, rather, because obviously there weren't any Russian horror movies for him to be influenced by, so... You know, that was where it was coming from. But it's very sort of gothic. And it's weird because although it's set in the contemporary period, in other words, I think the film was in the early 90s, so that's the background. But it could almost be the 1890s. You know, there's very little evidence of the modern world in this film, which is another interesting aspect of it.
Nice. I'm looking forward to this one.
Yeah, I think people will like that one.
Yeah, those are three films that I've heard of Symptoms. Because of the filmmaker, it was funny because he made a lot of like really oddball, like direct to video horror films in the '80s.
Yes, that's right.
He made like Edge of the Axe and Rest in Pieces and
That's it. Yeah.
Black. What is it? Black Curtains.
Black Candles.
Yeah, Black Candles. Yeah. You know, I was familiar with those films. I have never seen Symptoms, so that's going to be exciting. But I think my high point is this: the spider movie. That sounds. Definitely up my alley in weirdness.
Well, it's just so fun to discover films, you know. I mean, we're going to be talking about the American Horror Project soon, I believe, and I've been going through that, and these are three films I'd never heard of, and I'm, you know, been discovering those. And the same thing with, you know, discovering Lizard in a Woman's Skin, which was, you know, people knew about it, but I'm seeing it for the first time. But then films like these upcoming ones, you know, just – it's very fun – I think, to discover films in this genre that just seems, you know, to go around in circles with all the heavy hitter horror films to discover. But it's always fun to, for labels like Mondo Macabre, where you can actually really discover things.
Well, that's kind of what we aim to do. You know, it's one of the things anyway that we aim to do. Obviously you can't do it with every one, but you know, with every shot, but you know, you always try to, you know, to find these things which are, off-center, you know, not necessarily from the mainstream. And, you know, sometimes it's a bit of a struggle, and sometimes, you know, it's difficult to get people to, you know, take them seriously, in the sense that, you know, they there's always something else that is crying out for their hard-earned dollars, you know. But, I think, you know, it's always something that we try to do. And they've got it's a small audience, obviously, but... you know, I think it's a, you know, there are people who look for these things from us, and I think that's, you know, something I really want to carry on doing.
Nice.
Light the Fuse, Sartana is coming. That's the name of it.
There you go.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like Smoke and Aces, but without the hotel. It's like they find out that all this money's located in this area, then all these, like, fucking, you know, bounty hunter hitmen show up. You know, like there's the one, like there's the widow, there's the general monk, and they all just show up in this area, and it's a pretty cool movie.
Nice.
Yeah, those there was a lot of those Satana films made, wasn't there? He was one of the sort of series characters, wasn't he? I suppose it sounded like Satan or something. You know?
Yeah, that's the reason why I don't know. That's the reason why I probably said Satan, because it sounded so familiar.
So you grab it off the shelf.
Yeah. So. One film I was going to ask you about, because, you know, I'm sure you guys take recommendations. Have you ever seen a film called The Last Screening? It was made about 2011, and it is pure giallo. And it was only released in France.
What's it called? The last.
Yeah, the last screening. And it was only released in France and never really screened anywhere else, not available anywhere else. It just had a DVD release, and that's it.
I don't know.
That's my request. I think you would really, really, really – dude, it is really good, and it is full force 100% like 1970s giallo.
Huh.
Well, and it has to, well. And it's like – it even has like elements of like a Cinema Paradiso. Like, you know, kind of that fantasy theater feeling.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nothing like that, but that's vibes I even get from that movie. But yeah, the last screening, it sucks because it's only available like on DVD in France. There are English subtitles on the DVD though. But yeah, it's one of those films that really hits heavy with kind of the giallo 1970 feel, like Fulci Argento.
So. Oh, that's great. I mean, thanks. I'll check that out. I mean, I do recognize some of the names. I do know some of the people involved with it, so I can find out about it. But I noticed that Canal Plus are there, and that's probably one reason why it's not been sold overseas. They tend to be quite difficult to deal with.
Yeah, it's because there's actually a few giallo films that have come out that never made it to the States. The other one was it was kind of a loosely based remake of Suspiria. It was called Masks.
Oh, yes. That's a German film, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, you know, that was really good, too. And it was just like, it just sucks that those, you know, these films aren't widely available because it is that, you know, that genre that could slowly come back. I mean, we had, you know, Barbarian Sound Studio over here. We had, you know, Amir, The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, those films at least made it over here. But, you know, there's a few. And Julia's Eyes, too, which wasn't that well. You know, that kind of got shoved under the rug because it was that IFC thing. When any movie was released by IFC a few years ago, you never heard about it. But, you know, it was one of those IFC. Good. Yeah, it was ridiculous. I hated when they actually got the rights to a movie because you would never know it was released, and it got a DVD release and it was hardly available, and it was like $24 on Amazon. It's like, you want people to watch your movies. Come on, guys.
Yeah. Well, they had some strange, some strange deals, didn't they? Those guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that, so, you know, Masks, I do know that film. I mean, I've seen it. Yeah. I mean, that same director made one called The Tears of Carly a few years earlier, which did come out in America. Because we were chasing that film, and
haven't seen that one.
This is interesting because it came out for a company that I'd never heard of. You know, one of these companies that just seems to have had loads and loads of stuff out there, but that nobody ever knows anything about. And they paid a lot of money for it, you know, because I know the guys that produced that film, and you know, we were bidding for it, and they said, "Oh no, we've had, you know, somebody's offering us four times what you're offering." And it was like, wow, you know, and I think this is maybe the issue with Masks, you know, that they wanted a lot of money for it and no one in the States was prepared to stump up because it's, you know, a German film with unknown actors and so on, and kind of a hard sell, you know, for the money they were asking. I mean, that's my speculation. There's there's often reasons why things don't come out, and very often it's to do with the money. Sadly.
Yeah. Well, it says Tears of Kali, Maverick Entertainment Group. I've never even heard of those guys.
No. Well, I looked them up, you see, and there was like loads and loads of releases that they'd had, and like, I'd never heard of them, you know. And the weird thing is they dubbed the film into English.
Huh.
Really badly, you know, because it was filmed in German. They dubbed it really badly into English, but that must have cost them quite a lot of money.
Man, I'm excited to watch that. That sounds
good. It's actually better than Masks.
Yeah, Masks, like, Masks had a lot of potential. It just, it didn't achieve what it felt like it was trying to do. Like, I don't know what it was. Because the production value was there, the cinematography was there, the music was there. It was just, I don't know, something about the story. And I guess because it related so much to Suspiria in so many ways, I think that's kind of what took me out of it.
Yes, I agree, and I think the first half, the first third of the setup, and the first half of the film was really good, but then some guy gets involved in trying to sort out the mystery or something, doesn't he? And it all just sort of goes a bit kind of pointless, you know?
Yeah.
I remember being really quite intrigued by the first half and then being very disappointed by the second half, you know. Whereas I think The Tears of Kali is pretty good all the way through. It's kind of like three related kind of short stories, and it's quite creepy, and it's good, actually. It's worth watching.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about that one. I'll check that out. You check out the last screening and you let me know what you think.
I will. Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm very interested.
That movie, like, I saw that, man. I saw that movie like maybe five or like it's one of those movies I think about almost every single fucking day because it's not available anywhere. And like I actually bought it. I had to spend like $50 on the DVD, and you know I watch it, you know, quite frequently because it's a big inspiration to a screenplay that I wrote. You know, one of the very first screenplays I wrote was a Giallo film, but like it was, you know, that movie was fucking, oh man, dude, it's so good. Like if you love like those kind of tension builder giallo films, this is like it's like The Fifth Chord. That's what it feels like, you know. It's like that sense of dread that just hovers over you the entire movie. That's what I like.
The French young sort of French guys seem to be really into that whole giallo thing. I mean, there's a film called Black Aria as well, which came out about the same time as the last screening. Made by a bunch of young French guys, and it's pretty, I mean, it's, you know, it's got all kinds of faults because it was made for a tiny amount of money, but it's pretty good. Black Aria, it's probably worth checking
out.
How
do you spell that?
Black with A-R-I-A on the end, so Black Aria.
All our listeners are fucking having a time writing down of all these fucking movies.
I'm keeping track of them. Yeah, put them on the show notes.
We're just throwing recommendations out one another.
but that. I mean, that's not a great film, but it definitely shows that you know those young French filmmakers have a feel for that area, and they're definitely exploring you know, new possibilities with it. I mean, Amère, obviously you mentioned, and Strange Color of Your Body's Tears, whatever it was called, you know.
Yeah, The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears, yeah.
Those guys are really, it's a guy and it's a man and a woman.
Yeah, I think they're married, right?
I mean, they're obviously really influenced by that kind of, you know, 70s Italian, 60s, 70s Italian stuff. And they're kind of taking it to another level, you know, I think they're...
Well, yeah, that was kind of like a mirror. They told a story through three acts as a woman, like a woman's womanhood.
That's right.
As well, like her, you know, finding herself through these different situations, you know, and that was a very bizarre movie, but it you know, it worked. It was very, very well done. And, you know, those are the types of films that really grab me. And like Barbarian Sound Studio was one of them that I absolutely fucking adored because you have this guy. Have you seen that one, Pete?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I know Peter. Yeah, fairly well. Yeah, yeah.
It was just this film where, you know, this guy was scoring, like not scoring, he was doing like, you know, ADR and Foley for this, you know, this a giallo film called The Equestrian Vortex that we actually never see, but it spirals into his own story of giallo. And I thought that was so unique and so well done. And so just so weird, man.
Yeah, that was a special film. Yeah,
I got the UK Blu-rays. I need to. Yeah, pop it in soon.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet?
Not yet. I'm so far behind on my to watch pile. It's ridiculous.
Trust me, man. All of us are.
Yeah. Well, everyone has their homework now.
Yeah.
We got some movies for you guys to check out.
It's always good to you know, to sort of bring up new things that people may have missed. You know, because we can't, you know, we can't see everything. And sometimes it's like you were saying with that one, you know, you see it and it really affects you, you know, and you kind of think about it a lot, and that, you know, you can't talk about it to anyone because no one else has seen it.
Yeah. It's fun because people, you know, we all have seen, you know, different films, and I'm sure you sort a lot of stuff out with the shenanigans stuff that you watch.
You have to watch a lot of unsubtitled, you know, kind of 10th generation, you know, taken off of VHS kind of stuff. Sometimes it's difficult, you know, to judge whether anything is actually any good, you know, because obviously the visual of a film is a visual medium, and the visual quality of what you're looking at is really important. So when you're seeing a kind of a cropped, you know, 10th generation, you know, color film with all the color sort of taken out of it in a language you don't necessarily understand, I mean, you know, that is kind of quite, that's kind of quite a tough call, isn't it? But that's what you have to do sometimes, isn't it?
Wow. Yeah.
Awesome.
So,
well, okay. Pete, thank you so much for talking with us about this. I mean, it's one of those things where we all, especially you and Brad, can keep on going.
Yes, it is half past midnight here in the UK, so maybe
I'll start staying up and doing this with
you. I'll start to burble in a little
bit. Well, thank you for talking with us about Elizabeth in Woman's Skin. I believe you guys are stocking the stores that requested. You have plenty of stock, correct? I know that Grindhouse Video just got some in stock.
Yes, we were. Yeah, it sold more quickly than we expected. Uh-huh. So, but there was a little window where we didn't have any, but it's all out there again now.
Good. So the scalpers on eBay can relax. Chill out.
Yes.
Plenty of stock.
Well, I noticed that the the red box edition is there is a couple of people selling that on
eBay. That's stuff that always happens. Whatever.
I know. I just honestly, folks, it's not us. Trust me, we're not doing that.
Yeah, people are quick to say, "Oh, that's the distributor doing it."
Yes, it's not.
Oh man. But this is. I'm glad to hear that it's in stock. I know that a couple of people over the weekend that I was talking to online were trying to find it, and I guess they had checked like three or four different places, and they didn't have it in stock. Grindhouse Video, though, had it in stock. Grindhousevideo.com. They have some in stock there. I believe he's selling it for $19.95. A few of you got a good deal because he priced it wrong on accident.
Oh, good.
But you can get those there for sure. He has those in stock, and then it's good to hear that other stores, if you're looking for them, will be getting them in stock. So everyone, relax, buy the film. This is worth it. I mean, $19.95. That's a fantastic deal for this. It's just so stacked, you know. I look at, if I'm going to spend money on a movie, I want it to last me a while as far as digging through it, you know, and the extras, especially on films like this, you know, the extras are just fantastic. So it gets a high recommendation from me for sure.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Brad, do you have anything else for us before we close out?
No, I'm going to email Pete like a ton of titles now. Just go through.
Awesome. Brad's wheels are turning. All right, Pete, thanks again. We will definitely have you back on when some of these other titles come out for sure, because I definitely would like to – I'm definitely going to be grabbing them and we'll probably have questions.
That'd be great. Well, I look forward to it.
We are back after that interview. It's just me and BJ hanging out.
Yep, still back, still what's hanging, up? Still no Brad.
What's funny is in the interview, Brad gives me shit for doing shows with Adam, and he's not here today. He's not here on this part of the show, which is hilarious. So we're going to do our two segments here, and then we will we'll end the show. But first, we're going to jump into a little new segment I've been wanting to do with Josh Obershaw. We're going to test this out, see how it goes. We're going to do that right now. All right. Well, I've been wanting to do this this little thing for some time, and I know that Josh Obershaw has been hard at work over at thescreamcast.com putting up news and information about releases and all that stuff. And I wanted to try to do this little segment where we bring Josh on and he can rattle off some of the some of the news items of note that that have happened within the week and kind of see how this goes. So, Josh, what's up, man?
How you doing, Sean? Thanks for having me on again.
Of course. We're going to see how this goes and, maybe have it be a weekly thing or bi-monthly thing or whatever. So,
sounds good.
So it's been a pretty busy week, but, I'm going to turn it over to you. What are some of the things that you think, our listeners should be paying attention to?
Well, the first thing I want to start off with is an update from Scream Factory regarding a title they announced way back when at San Diego Comic-Con last year, and that's 1992's Death Becomes Her.
Mm.
And this is going to be a collector's edition. It's still coming out April 26th. I know it's been kind of delayed a couple of times, I believe, but it's definitely coming out April 26th. And the update is they've revealed the list of extras. And those include a new making of featurette called The Making of Death Becomes Her. It has interviews with director Robert Zemeckis, the writer David Koepp, and director of photography Dean Cundey. There's also a vintage making of featurette along with it, a photo gallery, and an original trailer. And that's pretty much it. That's it for the extras. I mean, for a collector's edition, it's kind of a little light on the extras. It doesn't even have new key art. Huh. But so that's the update on Death Becomes Her. Next, we have from Kino, The Taking of Pelham 123. Now, this is the original 1974 film starring Walter Matthau and Robert Shaw. It's coming out as a 42nd anniversary special edition, and there's a lot of features on this one.
Nice.
You've got a new interview with Hector Elizondo, an interview with composer David Shire, an interview with editor Jerry Greenberg. There's also a commentary with past Screamcast guest Pat Healy and film historian, Jim Healy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't notice that.
That's going to awesome. Be interesting. Another thing is an animated montage of stills and posters. Now, this is kind of not your run of the mill gallery of such things. So that's actually kind of cool. There's going to be a reversible Blu-ray art, and that one's coming out July 5th. So take note of that. And Friday was a busy one for Arrow. They revealed a bunch of Blu-rays that are going to be releasing on both sides of the Atlantic. For the U.S., they're going to be releasing Ray Harryhausen, Special Effects Titan. This is the documentary by Giles Penso. Hope I'm saying that right. It's got a bunch of interviews with Harryhausen himself, Joe Dante, John Landis, some of the big names you can think of. There's a whole list of extras that are going to be attached to this, such as interviews with Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg, and Rick Baker, 12 interview outtakes, a message to Ray, deleted scenes from the movie itself, something called On the Set of Sinbad, which I believe is probably behind the scenes stuff.
Oh, not the comedian?
No. they never really specified which Sinbad movie they're talking about, the Golden Age of Sinbad or the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. So I guess we'll find out when we see it.
This documentary is fantastic.
I haven't seen the documentary yet.
It was streaming on Netflix, and I watched it then. I guess if they've since taken it off Netflix, and I've been wanting to watch this again, and I want to collect as many of Harryhausen's films as I can. So it's great that this is coming out and actually being treated, you know, given a treatment, you know, like this. It's great.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. I grew up with a lot of the movies that Harryhausen has done. I remember seeing the original Clash of the Titans.
Oh, yeah.
At the drive-in when I was like 4 years old. So, yeah, I'm totally stoked with this one. And there's also a Ray Harryhausen trailer reel, which is going to be included on the special features of this one. This is coming out June 28th for those of you who are wanting that one. Also from Arrow, I know a lot of people are really excited about this one. It's Return of the Killer Tomatoes, starring John Astin and George Clooney, one of his early roles. So that's going to be fun to watch. I've never seen Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, believe it or not.
I've seen bits and pieces. It's one of the, I mean, it's not a good movie. I mean, it's not supposed to be, you know, but no. I remember the VHS art was always pretty awesome. And I think I've seen the first one. I'm waiting for someone to release that one on Blu-ray, but I haven't, I don't know who has the rights to that one, but,
neither do I, but considering, I mean, if this one does well, who's to say that Attack of the Killer Tomatoes might not get a Blu-ray release this year?
Yeah.
It's only a matter of time. On this one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you kind of, they're releasing US is just going to be a Blu-ray, but they're doing a DVD for UK as well as the Blu-ray.
It's going to be both Blu-ray and DVD in the UK only. So we're only getting the blue here in the States.
Ah, who cares? It's a coaster.
There you go. It's going to be presented with the original stereo audio. Plus, there's going to be optional English subtitles for the hearing impaired. There's going to be a new commentary with the writer and director, John DiBello, a new interview with actor Anthony Stark, an original trailer, reversible sleeve with new art by Matthew Griffin, in a fully illustrated collector's booklet featuring new writing by critic James Oliver.
Nice.
And this one is also coming out June 28th, by the way. And next up, from Code Red, this is actually going to be posted on the site probably tomorrow. Kingdom of the Spiders, the classic Shatner versus the Army of Spiders movie. So I don't have any information on this other than the fact that it's going to be a brand new HD 2K transfer. So yeah. Like I said, it's really, really in the early going.
Probably hold on to your Shout Factory DVDs, because that one had Shout Factory, right? That had released it last with a ton of special features. Because I don't think those special features will be making their way over onto Blu-ray if it's Code Red. I was kind of hoping that Shout Factory Screen Factory would be releasing this, but I think I was talking with Brad earlier today about this, and I think that this is a public domain title. I think. So it's kind of like one of those things that's up for grabs. Whoever releases it first, you know. But
yeah, it was kind of a shock.
But, you know,
it's kind of a shock seeing this, seeing Code Red actually release this one instead of Shout Factory. I thought that was really odd.
This is a big one, which is a shame, because sometimes Code Red gets these bigger titles like, I'm having a brain, can't think now. It's happened before where they've gotten a big title that everyone wants, and then it's just super hard to get. And I the movie escapes me right now, and it's driving me nuts. And I'm going to remember it at like midnight tonight. But that one should have been had a wide release, you know, and it didn't. And I'm lucky enough to have got that one on Blu-ray. Oh, gosh, what is that film?
Well, speaking of – it's going to bug you all night, isn't it?
God, man. Okay.
Well, speaking of Code Red, they announced that they're going to be bringing to Blu-ray the 1983 Conan cash-in Iron Master. And the only news that I have about that is an interview with Umberto Lenzi that's going to be all new. But other than that, there's nothing on the Code Red front. However, 5 days later, UK's 88 Films announced that they are going to be releasing Iron Master as well.
Yeah. That's a tough one, because I've been trying to get verification from 88 Films, because apparently Code Red is releasing the uncut version, because in the beginning there is they kill like a real life boar. So in the UK, I think that was cut. So I'm unsure if 88 Films is releasing the uncut version or the UK cut version. But it's like if it's just for that one scene of them killing a boar, I could really care less. But I'm trying to get verification from them. They have been ignoring my tweets, and they've ignored everyone on Facebook who's been asking about it. So I'm guessing that the 88 Films might be the cut version. But until we know exactly what's cut, like I said, I think that it's just the animal violence, the real life animal violence. You know, that's not gonna make it or break it for me. So, little caveat there.
All right, this is a title I haven't seen, so I didn't know what the semantics were about what was going to be left on the cutting room floor if it is going to be a cut version.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen it either. That's just what I gathered from scrolling through Code Red's posts and through 88 Films. Yeah. So, but they also said that they're going to be 88 Films is going to be, they have things on deck that are also Code Red titles. So, it's going to cause a little bit of competition. I think even though the 88 Films ones are probably going to be Region B locked, there's a lot of UK, people in the UK who want some of these Code Red films, but he personally does not ship overseas. He doesn't deal with that at all. He lets Screen Archives handle that, but he doesn't give all of his films to Screen Archives to distribute. So it's always kind of the thing of contention. But I don't know if you guys know this, though, but I don't think maybe it's a U.S. distributor, but I don't think U.S. distributors can legally ship overseas themselves. It must be something in the copyright, because I know that Grindhouse Releasing sends everyone asking about everyone who's overseas asking about buying, like they're trying to buy like the Pieces Blu-ray. They send everyone to Diabolik DVD, diabolikdvd.com, to handle the international sales. So I think there's something like legit about, you know, companies selling stuff like movies if they have only paid for the U.S. or the American rights, Region A rights, that they're not allowed to sell it overseas. But you can get over that with a distributor, like a store.
Okay, so I that's think how the whole import thing works.
Yeah, I think it's different, possibly different in the U.K. because I know the Arrow sends stuff here themselves. So I just think, you know, because that's the thing. People get on Code Red's butt about that and kind of bitch and moan about it. But I'm like, I've seen it from other distributors. Their kind of hands are tied the same thing, the same way. So I don't know. So, but I think some competition to Code Red would be good, because some of these titles are either.
And it's
going
to be fun to watch.
Oh yeah, it'll be entertaining. Go to the Code Red DVD Facebook group, and you'll be in for some fun.
Well, Sean, that's all the news I got for this week.
Cool, man.
But cool, so
yeah. Sounds good.
Like a lot of sorry.
No. So keep your eyes on the screamcast.com. Josh is pretty much posting all the news over there. Occasionally Brad and I will get in on it, but me and my, like, the three kids and the job and everything, like, I have a hard time keeping up with the stuff. Because that would mean I would have to use my work computer, which is kind of on some of the stuff.
Kinda dicey.
So I appreciate you stepping in and helping us out with all this. It is very much appreciated. So, all right. Well, we'll see how the response goes for this, and hopefully we'll have you back next week. Everyone, let us know what you thought of this little news segment. Give us some feedback. And, you know, I think it's fun. It adds a little bit to the show. We will we'll go from there.
It's actually been really fun.
All right, Josh.
It's been really fun. Hopefully we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks, Josh, for all you do. Appreciate it.
No problem.
So now let's jump into our two segments. Let's start off with some stream screams.
Nate, wake up!
There's something very important I forgot to tell you.
Don't fucking scream at me!
Scream of breaking neck.
Don't scream, miss. Don't scream.
Today we're talking 2009's, I think it was a straight-to-video, The Hills Run Red.
It was straight to DVD, mm-hmm. and that's a fucking bummer because it's awesome.
It is. Directed by Dave Parker. And this is one, like, I want to say I had, like, a renaissance in horror movies, kind of diving into the deep end and more kind of extreme horror movies. Because up till then, I was dabbling in, like, the 80s, you know, Friday the 13th and rewatching all those and Nightmare on Elm Street and kind of starting to get into movies like Demons and things like that. And I'd always kind of avoided, like, the more modern, like, torture porn type stuff and the more like, the gritty, dark, you know. But there was something about The Hills Run Red because that kind of caught my attention. I think it was probably the mask, the baby mask.
And oh, yeah, the baby face mask quickly kind of put itself right in place with kind of those famous horror masks. I mean, even if you haven't seen the film, The Hills Run Red is one of those films that everyone knows what the cover is, which mm-hmm. is so rare to happen anymore, just given, you know, how there's so many different cover arts based on what's on Redbox or what's on Netflix or what's on the DVD or what's on the Blu-ray. Everything is changing. So you really don't have that kind of staple of VHS. Oh, I remember that cover as a kid, or I remember seeing that cover. Hills Run Red, I think, is one of the last ones where everybody remembers that mask and the red background and just its creepy, cracked face.
Yeah. 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 The story's about, I mean, it's your basic kind of, it's almost like it's a backwoods slasher, but I mean, it's a group of like horror fans.
But it's a smart backwoods slasher.
Right. It's like we're here, we're post Scream, so the, you know, our heroes, our main characters, not necessarily heroes, our main characters, though, are horror fans. They know what to expect. I think one of them is a filmmaker, right?
I don't remember if he's an actual filmmaker or if he's... he's obsessed with...
I can't remember.
The fictional film of The Hills Run Red.
Right.
That's what it is. He's just fascinated by it and... completely obsessed with not just the film. He's also obsessed with the director who mysteriously disappeared, which I think is also very telling of kind of the society and the generation that this film was made for, because there are so many of us that are obsessed with a specific director. It's not, oh, I really like horror movies. It's, I really like the films of X, Y, and Z. It's a backwoods slasher, but it's fucking smart.
Yes, and in the beginning, we're introduced to the actress Sophie Monk.
You would like her.
I didn't know what to expect with this film, and it started, and luckily everyone was in bed. But she is a good-looking woman, and I was not expecting so much of her. And
I mean, you know,
that's it. It made an impression.
Well, that's what's also fun about it being a slasher is that it's similar to Scream, where it's paying homage but also writing a love letter to the genre. Mm-hmm. There's so many elements that are very much of kind of that golden slasher age of like, hey, you think this girl's hot? Good news. You're going to see every inch of her.
And here I am. I'm sounding like the pig right now, you know, but she's an attractive woman. And what are you going to do? You know,
you're fine.
What am I going to cover my own eyes?
It's not exploitation or objectification when people are, you know, presenting it as such. Like you can't objectify somebody that is, you know, presenting themselves as an object and is proud to do so.
Right.
It's like the whole beauty pageant thing. You can't objectify a beauty queen because like, oh, it's objectification. No, they have chosen to do this.
Right.
So
there you go.
That's the argument I always give. You're welcome. You're not scum. If you like walk up to her on the street and you're like, oh, you're a hot piece of ass. Yeah, you're a piece of shit.
Right.
So don't worry about it.
But this also stars William Sadler, which I'm always happy to see him in films. But the other actors, I'm not sure. I don't really recognize. Do you know what other movies that they've been in?
Which actor?
There's Tad Hilgenbrink, Janet Montgomery, and Alex Windham are the main characters in the film. It's a small, you know, small lower budget film.
I'm sure that they've all done things that I've seen. They've just unfortunately not really kind of stuck out for me.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Tad Hilgenbrink was in he was in the what is it called amusement, the like that weird amusement park like clown killer movie.
Yeah
he's kind of like one of the main dudes in that, because that movie's centered mostly around girls, but he's like the dude in that. But I don't think that he's really done anything since The Hills Run Red, like anything of merit, that is. So I don't think he's done anything. And then Janet Montgomery. I'm not entirely. Oh, she's on Salem. I'm a fucking idiot. Yeah, she's on Salem. And she was in the Christmas episode of Black Mirror. And that's all I've got. I'm sure she's done plenty of other things, but that's all I've got. Everyone else, I don't know you.
Well, the reason why we're bringing this up is like this was not was not released in Blu-ray yet, but you can get an HD copy on Vudu, Vudu.com, or at probably any streaming service. You can probably find this streaming HD. And it's owned by Warner Brothers, so I don't know if this will ever see a physical release, but you can get it in its HD glory through these streaming services. So that's why we wanted to bring it up. I know that, oh gosh.
Well, you can get it on DVD.
Yeah.
But yeah, as far as like anything better, probably not for a while, which is a bummer.
Never made the jump to Blu-ray. And Rob, I'm going to butcher his last name. He's writing for Blumhouse right now. Was doing Icons of Fright.
Rob Gluzzo.
Gluzzo, yes.
I muted myself in the middle of that somehow.
he wrote a great little write-up on Blumhouse.com about films. He has two articles up there right now, but one's foreign films that haven't made it to Blu-ray that should, and then kind of domestic films that never made it the jump to Blu-ray from DVD that that should. And this was on that list. So
yeah, it absolutely should. And if anyone out there watched Tales of Halloween, Dave Parker's segment was the opening, Sweet Tooth. And that was probably one of the best of the whole thing. So, you know, if you're looking for more of his work, you definitely, definitely, definitely want to check it out, because it's creepy and weird and awesome. And Dave Parker should be getting $1 million billion to make whatever he wants, because he's super talented.
Oh, that's right. He did that Sweet Tooth one.
Mm-hmm. So, like, that anthology opens on a hell of a high note.
And yeah.
He sets the bar for that whole movie.
I'm trying to remember. Like, that one had how many little episodes were in that?
10.
Like 10?
Mm-hmm.
I have a list somewhere of my favorite ones. But that definitely was on there.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, Hills or Not is so fantastic, and I think it gets lost because there were so many shitty movies that came out kind of in that early to mid-2000s, where just everything was getting dumped on direct to DVD, because that's when the start of not having money for this sort of stuff started to really kick in, because that's when piracy really started to rear its head. And so many movies just got dumped, and this was one that did, and it shouldn't have, because it's wonderful. And it's so much fun, and it's a horror fan's horror movie.
Yeah. This is where I credit horror websites, because I remember at the time I was reading a lot of Bloody Disgusting and Dread Central. I think were the two main ones that I was reading. Probably the only two that were really of any note at that time, at least that I knew of, because I was kind of like, I was like trying to find everything I could. Like, I would go through Dread Central and just like go to reviews and what movies have I missed, and just make a list of all the things that had like 3.5 or more daggers. And this one got talked up quite a bit by all these websites. So I would have never checked it out if it wasn't for, you know, Dread Central or Bloody Disgusting, for sure.
Yeah, no, this was definitely one that I think has the following it does based on word of mouth, which kind of goes back to my talking about it being similar to, you know, finding that gem of the VHS tape. Mm-hmm. I think this was definitely that gem, you know, whereas we don't have video stores anymore, but we do have kind of the fucking landfill of direct-to-DVD stuff, and this is that diamond in the rough. This is the one that you would, you know, scrounge to find the one good thing, and this is the one good thing. I know a lot of people aren't sure how to take this film, because it is a lot more brutal than you think it would be, but I just think it's a lot of fun. I think that and ultimately that's what I'm looking for with my horror films now, is I'm really just looking for something that's fun. And it's a well-crafted film. It's very, very smart. and it's fun. So two thumbs up, toots the house down. I think it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what it is about, like, because it does get grisly. It goes dark.
Oh, yeah. It gets super dark.
But I think, I don't know. Like, it's not, it's just trying to be its own thing, and it knows what it is, and it knows the tropes that these slasher movies follow.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's done with a cleverness, I think. Even though it takes itself seriously and gets really brutal, it's not, I guess, overly trying to play for laughs. It knows its audience is smart, and it knows its audience is well versed in these films, so it doesn't have to try to joke it up, you know, and be, you know, like, try to be an 80s slasher. You know, it's its own thing. You know, I think a lot of these movies try too hard, I think, to just, you know, ape what's done before.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just something about this one. Like, this, did this come out at the same time as Wolf Creek?
I don't know if it was
the same time.
I don't know if it was the exact same time, but definitely in that sort of same couple of years.
There's like all these movies were kind of coming out like they were a slasher, but they were just kind of like just everyone was just caked in dirt and blood, you know?
Yeah.
And just grimy. But this is one of those movies that I think definitely got it right. And if you haven't seen it, you can rent it on voodoo.com.
Wolf Creek came out first.
Okay. I discovered all these. I started watching all these movies around the same time because I had always kind of avoided the things that got too dark and too brutal. Mm-hmm. I was more looking for kind of just fun, more like supernatural, you know, like demons and stuff like that in the 80s. And I'd kind of avoided like the things that I knew were going, you know, just dark and brutal and serious. But, something about this movie just, I think it was just the right recipe, I think, this type of film.
Mm-hmm.
Not only because of Sophie Monk. That was icing on the cake.
She is real cute, though. Let's be real.
But, all right, cool. I'm sure if Brad was on, he'd have more to say. But
but he not here.
He'll move on. Let's move on. Are you ready to move on to the next segment here?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm excited to hear you go oh, off God. On this segment.
Oh, God.
Nikki.
Well, here we are at last. Right where we ought to be.
Oh my God!
Earlier in the week, Brad and I were trying to figure out what movies we're going to cover for these segments, and he gave me a list, and I just, you know, picked from the list. And the movie that I picked is a 1990 trauma film called Crystal Force. And before he turned us down to come on the show tonight, he texted
he
me
didn't
saying,
"Turn us down."
Before he decided to just not want to be on the show with us and go hang out with his lady friend, as he should have. But he said that this technically shouldn't be in the VHS Oh My God segment because technically it's on DVD. So after I told him I hated him, because I watched this film already, I did some digging around, and Troma is releasing this as a kind of burn-on-demand service. So if you buy this from Amazon, they will burn you a DVD-R of the VHS transfer, basically. And it's the transfer that they're actually showing on their own YouTube website. So you can watch this for free on YouTube on Troma's channel. So I'm like, technically it's on DVD, but, you know, it's not a better transfer than you'll get from VHS. So
yeah,
I think with all those caveats.
There you go. You can read.
Third time's a charm. We'll give this one a pass. So Crystal Force, here we go. 1990. Directed by Laura Keats, a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly enough, because there's a lot of TNA in this one. I don't know if I really know the plot. I don't know. Like, a woman finds a crystal or is given a crystal by this mustached guy walking dogs.
He's the master of the crystal.
And all hell breaks loose in the last 15 minutes.
Yep, pretty much.
But it's so it opens up like, I don't know, like there's a funeral, so someone has died. And our main character, I just had a hard time following this film.
There's not much to follow, if I'm going to be completely honest with you. So don't feel bad. I think the problem with a film like Crystal Force is that it is being, you know, created by Troma. And we have this weird love and affinity for Troma because they're a little schlocky, they're kind of shitty, and everyone's like, oh, well, that's just the style, that's the Troma style. And because of that, people make excuses for the films that legitimately just aren't fucking any good. And Crystal Force is one of those films. Like, Toxic Avenger, kind of cheeseball. Return to Nukem High, total cheeseball. But
yeah,
they're fun. They're still really fun. Crystal Force is a hot fucking mess, but we give it a pass because, oh, well, it's a Troma film. You have to get Troma films. No, I get Troma films. I understand Troma films. This is just a shitty movie.
That's my question is, was this made by Troma or was this released by them?
I think it was released by Troma.
Right. So there's like a slight difference because the Troma movies like Toxic Avenger, those things are batshit crazy.
Those are 1,000% like Lloyd Kaufman Troma films.
Right.
This is something I want to say they just released, but it doesn't matter. Like, the second you get that like Troma bumper, everyone suddenly is like, oh, we can forgive every shitty thing about it because it's a Troma film. It's like, no, you cannot.
I mean, not a whole hell of a lot happens really for the first hour, I think.
Yeah, and this movie is like not even 90 minutes.
It's an hour, 20 minutes. So the first hour is very slow going. You get some TNA going. For some reason, she's having a dream or whatever. She ends up naked in a room with two other people having sex.
Because why not?
I don't know, but it's there. And then you get the girls getting together to do a seance with this crystal. And a few things happen. You know, a pentagram gets projected onto the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Some creepy stuff happens. You have this this mustachioed, you know, keeper of the crystal. What's his name? It's not Beelzebub, but it's like Beezle.
Something similarly as stupid.
He's kind of lurking in the background, kind of giggling and monologuing to himself. But then, within the last 20 minutes, the demon or whatever is summoned from the pentagram. And some things go down, and it is not very well shot.
And it's not even cheesy in like a fun ridiculousness. It's just bad.
I'm lost on who all the main characters are. I'm like Brad says, I'm horrible at retelling movies, and I apologize. But the main guy character, is it Sparky? Is that him or is it Jack? Is Sparky?
Risky.
Risky. There's Risky and Jack. I don't know who the main character was. Anyway, all the girls get attacked by this thing. They all move out in front of the house. The police are called. He says something like, call for backup to the girls. And then he runs inside the house, and I swear and it's dark, like it's not even lit. And he's looking through like the cabinets and cupboards, but you can't see anything. And I swear it goes on for like 2 minutes of just him stumbling in the dark and not finding what he's looking for.
God.
It's like I paused it and went and did something and came back to finish watching it, and he was still looking through the cabinet. So it felt like it was 10 minutes.
It probably was 10 minutes. They probably were like, how can we stretch this hour movie into an actual feature film?
It's pretty bad. I mean, the only thing really going for it is the cover art is pretty fantastic.
It is really cool. You know that this film has a sequel?
I just saw that.
I'm never going to watch it because I have better things to do with my life. What's it called?
Crystal Force 2 Dark Angel. Because we couldn't think of another, if anything less.
Because it's 1994, and that's what we had to do. If it sounds like it could be a screen name, we're using it.
Oh, man. Anyway, I posted that I was watching this on one of the Facebook forums and Facebook groups or whatever, and somebody was like, oh, I remember that when I was a kid. Does it hold up? You know, and I was like,
no.
This thing is not good at all. So if you want to brave this thing, it's on YouTube, Troma's channel. It's legit YouTube. I mean, that's kind of cool, I think.
Yeah, because it's got like the commercial breaks in it. And
I didn't see any commercial breaks.
What? Mine has commercial breaks.
Really?
Like ad breaks, I should say.
Mine never had any ads.
YouTube ad breaks.
I was watching it on my phone.
Jealous? Oh, maybe that might be why.
Because I was like, why project this to my... I mean, actually, I watched half of it projected to my TV, which is this cool thing in the YouTube app where it's like, if you have a compatible Blu-ray player, you just press the thing and all of a sudden it shows up on your TV, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, I use my Chromecast for that, which is pretty sweet.
So that's cool. But then after I was watching it on the big screen, I was like, yeah, I don't really have to. So I kind of would have it on while I was like washing dishes.
Well, I mean, there's only one way to watch a movie that has a rotating pentagram projection on the wall.
Fantastic.
And doing chores is probably hilarious. The best.
Well, it just wasn't going anywhere. Normally, I like to sit down without distractions. But by 30 minutes in, I knew this wasn't going to go anywhere for a while. And I kind of, if you've seen enough of these movies, you know that, okay, they're going to get batshit in the last 10 to 15 minutes. So let me kind of ride it out till then. And... and sometimes it's worth the wait. In this case, I mean, there's a few giggles, but you know, it's a movie, folks.
Yep.
It wasn't as amazing as I wanted it to be. Just say that.
I don't know why he recommended that. Usually he recommends something we're gonna love. So part of me thinks that maybe he secretly loves it. But he's not here to defend it, so we're going to shit on it. Sorry about
Basically, that's what we'll assume is Brad adores this film. Well, I guarantee you he saw it when he was like 13.
Yeah, you heard it here first, and, guys. Brad Henderson loves Crystal Force.
We'll have to ask him about it next week. All right. That's all we got to say about that, right?
Yeah, I have nothing more.
All right. Finally, the last thing that I wanted to talk about, since, you know, we've gotten kind of, you know, talked about social issues these past couple weeks, why stop now? The Wachowskis are now the Wachowski sisters, which
I am so happy about.
I was shocked, I think. Most of the time you can kind of see that kind of thing coming. But in this case, like for me, it was a huge surprise. Should it not have been?
I don't think that. I think the reason that it's such a surprise to so many people is because the likelihood of somebody being transgender in the first place isn't, you know, quite that high.
Uh-huh.
So the fact that it's, you know, not only within the same family but also siblings is kind of a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that just kind of further proves the point that you're born that way and it's not a choice and people are stupid if they think it is. but I think the real telling thing about it as well is that Lily had not planned on going public with this quite yet.
Right.
But was kind of forced to because the media of the Daily Mail, who they're just the fucking worst. The Daily Mail was essentially going to out her. And I think that that's kind of deplorable that we still live in an age where you can have that kind of power over somebody's personal life where outing is still a thing. I really hate that. I think that it's disgusting. But I am super excited that now I can officially determine, you know, who in my life is a garbage person, because I would,
exactly.
I would constantly correct people who would refer to the Wachowskis as like the Wachowski brothers still, which I understand when Matrix came out, that's what they were credited as. I get that. But because, you know, Lana has been given so many awards, you know, for her trans visibility within the public eye. There's just no excuse for people to have ever referred to them as brothers. I think that is so disrespectful. And now that Lily is also out, it's deplorable when people are still calling them the Wachowski brothers. It's so insulting and gross.
Well, now you can say sisters if you want to keep
saying
that.
Right, yeah, exactly. And now there's no excuse to, you know, slip that up. But I think that it's extremely important because the likelihood that we have people that are on any sort of, you know, queer spectrum and making huge big budget movies just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And if they do, it's never really talked about. But now we have, you know, these siblings who created one of the most successful film franchises of all time, and they are transgender, and that's unbelievable to me. I think
it's very
that
high profile.
Yeah, it's high profile, but it's also so very, very important because there is such a stigma attached to people who are transgender or fall somewhere within kind of the queer spectrum. And it just goes to prove that it doesn't fucking matter.
Yeah.
It really doesn't. And it doesn't change your work ethic or your skill or your talent or your intellect or any of these things. And the Wachowski sisters are living proof of that. And I am so happy that, you know, now they can finally be who they always have been, the way they would have loved to have always been. And I'm really excited to see, you know, what comes from them. I mean, I don't know if you watched Sense8 at all.
I started watching it. Yeah, I haven't finished it yet.
And I think that they're already just creating, especially ever since Lana, transitioned, it seems that their work started to become a little bit more, you know, socially conscious and progressive. And that's exciting to me because that makes me think that we're going to finally get these stories from different viewpoints that we haven't been getting. I mean, I'm sure that there are plenty of interesting stories that still have yet to be told by straight cis white men. I'm pretty sure that there's probably a couple more we haven't heard. But the idea that, you know, not only do we have trans creators, but siblings that are trans that are going to be telling stories is so fucking cool to me. I don't know. I'm pumped about it. I think that it's a great day for not only female filmmakers, but, you know, trans filmmakers and genre films as a whole, because I think that the high profile announcement of this is going to make, you know, hopefully, I mean, in a perfect world, will hopefully make it easier for those that aren't cis white straight men.
Yeah.
To, you know, get work, you know?
Yeah. And, so. And you don't have to be like, leaning socially, like in your work. Cause a lot of people think like, oh, they're transgender. So now they're just gonna make a bunch of transgender movies, you know?
Yeah. And that's just not
true.
But
they're filmmakers and storytellers first and foremost, and nothing's going to change. I thought it was interesting how, is it Lana?
Lana.
Mm-hmm. She kind of transitioned like under the radar. I remember I didn't really pay any attention.
Both did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lana, what happened is they like kind of fell off the planet for a little bit and nobody really knew what was going on with the Wachowskis. And then Lana became this kind of public figure. You know, she reintroduced herself, which was, you know, fantastic. And then they started creating again, but we didn't really see a lot of Lily. We saw a lot of Lana. Lana became very visible.
Uh-huh.
You know, she spoke at the GLAAD Awards and all sorts of stuff and, you know, kind of became this social figure. But Lily kind of fell to the wayside and nobody really saw much of her. And now we know why. Because for a while I thought it was just because, you know, Lana had, you know, come out as transgender and that was we're finally becoming a bit more progressive and that we accept and are more understanding when this happens and it's not like your life is over, your career has ended. That just, I mean, to some extent, that obviously that's going to happen. People are shitty no matter what. No matter how you slice it, people are shitty. But it's not nearly as problematic as it used to be. It's still definitely got a lot of ways to go, but it's not, you know, an end of the world sort of situation.
Yeah.
But I figured, you know, Lana's in the public, so yeah, nobody really wants to talk to, you know, who at the time would have been, I believe,
Andy.
Nobody really cares because, you know, it's just another straight white dude. Nobody cares. But now we know the real reason that we, you know, weren't seeing much of, you know, who would have been Andy was because, you know, Lily. And yeah. I think that it's very cool that both of them were kind of able to transition on their own terms and out of the limelight, because that's a crazy enough process to be, you know, to begin with. But then to add the fact that these are such well-known figures,
mm-hmm.
I mean, fucking God bless Caitlyn Jenner. I could not do that. I could not, you know, document every moment of, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's not an easy thing to do to come out like that, especially given the fact that, you know, there's going to be the people that are going to say shitty things because, you know, Lana came out first, and it's going to be obnoxious because people are just so ignorant on the topic. But Lily seems to be very happy, and, you know, the photo she posted, she looks so genuinely happy. And then you compare that to the photos of the Wachowski sisters pre-transition, and it is like night and day. There is so much joy and life and happiness in their faces. And, you know, anybody can see that just by looking at photos of them. So anyone who wants to say that it's not real, you know, they can suck eggs.
But it's like, we're humans. We can, we're kind of masters of our own destiny. So it's mm-hmm. like, if that's what makes you happy and you're not hurting anyone else, why the hell not? Just
right. Yeah.
You know, what I was gonna say about Lana was it was, I had no idea, cause I was just, you know, I just didn't know where the Wachowskis had been. And I saw that documentary or them talking about Cloud Atlas. And I was like, oh shit. One of them's a woman now. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just like, and I think that's what Lily wanted to do, but these shitty, you know, press always thinks that they have to, you know, get these scoops out, you know, for just to sell or to get clicks now, right? Because that's all everyone's after right now is clicks. And to get a scoop of Lily, you know.
Daily Mail is just, they're so scummy.
Yeah.
Everything they do just makes me mad, because I don't know why we haven't resorted to just treating them like the tabloid trash that they are. But for whatever reason, people still consider them to be like a respectable source of news. And they're the most disrespectful people. Yeah, it's gross. I get so like knee-jerky pissed off whenever I hear about media outlets that try to do shit like this, because it's blackmail.
Yeah.
Cut and dry. It's fucking blackmail. And you can call it freedom of the press, right to free speech, whatever you want. It's blackmail.
You're messing with people. In this case, you're messing with people's lives. And, you know, it's just, it just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, it does, you know, because that's all, you know, any news outlet wants to get their attention. But, you know, to mess with somebody's life like that, to force them basically to come out, in something that they were going to, in their own way, let the world know, because they're filmmakers. We're going to find out one way or another. But I think, you know, they handled it well. And, you know, what Lily wrote was great. And
oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, and so, I also think that's what's even better about the Wachowski sisters is that, you know, I don't really believe in, you know, pinning people against each other and, you know, tearing down one person to make another person look better. It's not really my style, but the obvious comparisons are, you know, the Wachowskis and Caitlyn Jenner,
mm-hmm.
because of, you know, just people that were high profile pre-transition, And the Wachowskis are just so aware of not only their privilege in being, you know, wealthy and having a supportive family, and still trying to remind the public that, you know, their stories are not, you know, typical, and that the amount of people that are trans and are coming out or transitioning, it's a very difficult process. And a lot of times they don't have that support system. They don't have people to back them up. I mean, the crime rates for trans women is out of fucking control. Like, 1 in 12 trans women is going to be, you know, brutalized at some point in their life. That's fucking nuts. So the fact that they take, you know, take it to heart how important it is for them to kind of be these pillars for the trans community, I think is wonderful, because they understand, you know, kind of the with great power comes great responsibility sort of thing. And it just, they're the best people. Like, I love
hearing them.
I am so ride or die for them. I've been, you know, a big Wachowski fan since day one.
And
I'm just excited to see, you know, where their art is going to go now that they're not going to be feeling so quite so conflicted.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's part of it. I mean, people shit on, you know, Jupiter Ascending quite a bit. And it's a goofball movie, but I think that's kind of what they were trying to do. Just make this space opera, goofy space opera. But,
Absolutely.
But movies like, when I saw Cloud Atlas, like, to me, like, you know, people will nitpick things to death. But to me, there's something about that film that's so honest and just beautiful. I adore that movie, and it had a huge kind of effect on me, because I can tell that they were telling a story from their heart, like, no matter them. And then with the director of Run Lola Run, his name escapes me right now, but like them together, like, that was something amazing, and it didn't really get the respect it deserved. So I'm hoping, you know, that with their kind of newfound, like, them being comfortable in their own skins now, and it'll give them the kind of maybe empowerment, or the, you know, I don't know, the creative juices flowing again to make something as affecting, I think, as Cloud Atlas. But, you know, we'll see what happens. Studio, they're studio directors, you know, and it's amazing that Cloud Atlas even got made. So,
hopefully, I would love to see what they would do with, like, a Marvel property.
Yeah.
I would love that, because it would be totally fucking weird, and I would love it. Give them something weird to do.
Yeah. Give them some weird stuff, and they'll deliver.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this week's show.
I think so.
I want to make sure you guys all check out our sponsors. Go to thescreamcast.com/sponsors. And give them some love. I mean, we have people asking how they can support the show and what they can do. I mean, all we really say is please go check out our sponsors. We have some new ones that we're working with that we can't really announce yet, but we're working on a few others. But check out Coffee Shop of Horrors. You can always use the code SCREAMCAST for 10% off your order. Grindhousevideo.com, of course, we took off the coupon code. Just because, I mean, he's a small, you know, business, and it was like, right now we want to make sure he's making all the profits he can to survive.
Yeah. So,
that really wasn't the right thing, I think, for their situation. But please go to grindhousevideo.com. His prices are reasonable, and know that you're supporting, you know,
supporting an independent business, independent
store, rather than, than Amazon. And I think that means a lot. But he is going to be getting involved in some of the drawings. He will have some giveaway stuff. So that's the role that he'll be taking in with the sponsorship. But good stuff. I think they have a decent price on a lizard in a woman's skin. The last time I checked, it was like $19.95, which at the time was the best price around. Because there was some short supply, and some, not all the websites had got restocked. And Amazon was up to like $30. So check that out. He'll have some good prices there. He also, I believe he has some left, but he has a Grindhouse releasing pieces.
And yes. I
think, don't quote me on that, but I think they're the ones with the puzzle in there. So
very cool.
And of course, Wolfmen of Mars continue to keep churning out music. So go to bandcamp.com/wolfmenofmars. Or no, wait, it's wolfmenofmars.bandcamp.com and buy up all their music. They're also available on, if you do streaming, on iTunes Music, I believe, and on Spotify. And of course, inkspatters.com. Give Kevin Spencer some love. He did all the, he designed the logos for the site, and he's starting to jump back into more artwork. So definitely check out his artwork and buy some of his prints and some of his t-shirts. And that's how you can support us. We're going to try to do a Patreon, I think, because as a website now that we have some writers, I do want to at least pay the writers and get some money to pay them for what they do. I can care less about making any money. Brad and I are on the same boat. I'm sure BJ, you are too.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
if we're going to be churning out content on the website, I want to at least be paying our contributors what they deserve for their contributions. So next few weeks, I'm sorting things out. I'm kind of trying to budget it out and see how much we should be pulling in per month to at least be fair to everybody. But keep an eye out for that. So if you want to support the show that way, support the content on the site, that'd be a great way to do it. God, my dog is freaking out right now.
I was going to ask what was going on.
She wants out. Bailey, what are you doing? Who's here? What's going on? Who's here? I thought I was going to get a bark out of her. Anyway,
does she also get candy when she shits?
Over at thescreamcast.com, there's all of our social media links. Follow us on there, and I'll be, once I get everything settled, be tweeting out the Patreon stuff. I want to kind of dial it in and get it right. And that's a way you can help support the show. So we're not doing, we have never done this to make this a job or make money or anything like that. But if we can cover, you know, content on the site and then eventually cover some of the incurring costs that I pay out of my pocket to keep this running and everything, you know, that's fair, right? I think. But all that's down the line. I'm not going to force the issue at all on that. I just want to pay the writers.
Yeah.
All right, and with that, we'll talk to all of you guys next week. Be patient with us this month. I am going to Hawaii the last week of the month.
I hate you so much.
So we're going to try to get a couple extra episodes out. I don't know. Brad's going to be going to South by Southwest, so I think we're going to have a South by Southwest roundup and then an Arrow episode of the next
two. I'm just
going to
do a
one-woman
show.
And then BG will do a one-woman show. That's what we got working. We'll talk to all of you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, don't tell me you're leaving. The party's just begun.